so for a reason.
Mahabharata Now continues on Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of August. Good morning. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Michelle Hussein.
The Prime Minister will promise to reverse a decade of decline in a speech in Downing Street later as he lays out the challenges ahead. We'll speak to the Labour Party chair as well as the General Secretary of the TUC. Russia has launched waves of missile and drone strikes across Ukraine for a second night, targeting Kyiv and other cities.
Also in today's programme, the NHS 111 service now has a new option for people in need of mental health support.
If people have a mental health problem, if they are in crisis, we've just taken another huge step forward by introducing 111, who can put you through to your local crisis line.
And we'll speak to best-selling crime novelist Anne Cleeves about her new book, inspired by a report she heard here on Radio 4. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Prime Minister will promise to reverse a decade of decline when he delivers a speech in the Rose Garden of Downing Street later. But he'll also warn that things will get worse before they get better. Sir Keir Starmer will say this summer's riots didn't just betray the sickness in society, but also revealed the cure to work together to fix the foundation for the long term. Here's our political correspondent Ben Wright.
Speaking before Parliament returns next week, Sir Keir Starmer will say it won't be business as usual. No more division and distraction, no more politics of performance. He will deliver this message in the Downing Street Rose Garden in front of 50 people he met during the election campaign, from small business owners to firefighters. Promising a government of service, Sir Keir will say rooting out 14 years of rot under the Conservatives will take hard work and time, that things will get worse before they get better. Downing Street hopes that by being frank about the scale of the challenge and flagging the need for unpopular decisions, voters will be on board. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has already warned that repairing the public finances is likely to mean some tax rises in her autumn budget. The Conservatives dismiss the speech as a performative attempt to distract the public from promises they claimed Sir Keir Starmer never had any intention of keeping.
The Ukrainian military says Russia has launched several waves of missile and drone attacks targeting the capital and other regions for a second day. Reports from Kyiv suggest there have been at least three rounds of explosions overnight and three people have died. The region's military administration said air defence systems were deployed several times to repel missiles and drones. Michael Bosicu, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, is in Kyiv. He says water and power supplies have been affected.
Critical infrastructure has been hit and hit very, very hard. In fact, one of the objects struck yesterday was a 408-megawatt Kyiv hydroelectric power plant. So hence, we have most of the days now with no power than with power. So it doesn't look good at all in the longer term, especially for the winter.
The UN says that new Israeli evacuation orders in Gaza have dealt a serious blow to its aid efforts, sending humanitarian workers fleeing from its operations centre. Violence has also flared in the occupied West Bank, where medics say one Palestinian was shot dead by an Israeli settler and five others were killed in an Israeli airstrike. More than 3,500 current and former workers at Next have won the final stage of a long-running battle for equal pay. The case centred on whether shop floor staff, mainly women, are entitled to the same hourly pay as their largely male colleagues who earn more working in the retailers' warehouses. An employment tribunal found the retailer had indirectly discriminated against the claimants. Here's our business correspondent Emma Simpson.
This case has taken 6 years. First, the store staff had to prove their roles were comparable to their colleagues working in Next warehouses. Then they had to prove their work was of equal value. Finally, an employment tribunal had to decide whether there was any reason other than sex discrimination why they were being paid less. Next argued it was down to market forces and the need to pay a higher going rate to recruit and retain warehouse staff. But the tribunal ruled that wasn't enough of a defence, although it didn't uphold the claims of direct discrimination.
The UN Secretary General has said big polluters have a clear responsibility to cut emissions or risk a worldwide catastrophe. Antonio Guterres is in Tonga for the Pacific Island Forum leaders meeting. He told the BBC the world's biggest emitters, especially China and the US, needed to take urgent action.
There is an obligation for them to come together, to share technologies, to look into what the science is fortunately now producing, to make sure that emissions are drastically reduced in this decade. We need to recognize that it is totally unsustainable for the planet to go on as we are.
And there's an expectation this morning that Oasis are about to announce a reunion. It's been 15 years since the band split up after brothers Liam and Noel Gallagher fell out. But in recent days, both have teased an announcement for today through cryptic posts on social media. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
It's exactly 30 years since the Gallagher brothers shot to fame. But the siblings have had a fractious relationship. After a fight in 2009, Noel left the band. Since then, fans of the Manchester group have pleaded with the brothers but to get back together again. On Sunday, cryptic posts on X by both Liam and Noel Gallagher, as well as on the band's official page, which just showed today's date, the 27th of August, and the time is 8 a.m, fueled rumours that a reunion could be imminent.
That was our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. Well, we'll be reflecting on that announcement, whatever it may be, at about 8:20. For now, it's 6 minutes past six, and we're going to say good morning to Simon King, who's got the weather. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Emil. Good morning. Yeah, we've got some pretty blustery winds once again across many parts of the UK, but more so towards northern and western areas where we've got some heavy rain spreading in. But towards eastern and southeastern England, you're not going to see any of that rain. It's a pretty mild start to the day, and it's going to stay dry with some sunshine throughout. You might notice the breeze picks up into the afternoon. It will be warmer than yesterday with maximum temperatures about 22 to 24 degrees, but maybe 25 or 26 in some parts of East Anglia and the far southeast. For southwest England and the Midlands, it's a generally bright start today with some sunny spells. The cloud will thicken though in the west, where there could be a little bit of rain moving its way into the far southwest later in the day, and again turning quite breezy with temperatures of 18 to 23 Celsius. For Wales, northwest and northeast England, a blustery day with some pretty strong gusts of wind actually around the coasts at the moment. It's dry with some sunshine this morning, but turning pretty overcast by lunchtime as rain spreads in from the west, and that rain will be particularly heavy for parts of northwest England, north and west Wales, and it'll be quite misty and murky around those coastal areas as well. The further east you are, it'll stay a little bit drier, temperatures of 17 to 21. Now for Northern Ireland, it's a mild start with some rain moving through fairly quickly actually, so there'll be some sunny spells and blustery winds, temperatures of 19 or 20 degrees, and across Scotland, a very wet start to the day at the moment, lots of standing water with heavy bursts of rain and strong winds. Rain will push to the south and east and clear from northern parts with some sunny spells and highs of 16 to 20 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much for that. 8 minutes past six. Let's have a look at today's papers, with The Guardian leading this morning on what it calls the staggering rise in anxiety among children since the COVID pandemic. It says official figures show that more than 500 young people a day are being referred to NHS mental health services in England for anxiety. Experts tell the paper there are a number of reasons, including worries about exams, the influence of social media, and post-pandemic uncertainty. The paper says mental health leaders fear the figures may only be the tip of the iceberg, and that the situation lays bare an urgent need to tackle the crisis in children's mental health.
The Daily Telegraph reports that police are increasingly letting knife and sex offenders escape prosecution if they say sorry. The paper says that in the year to March, more than 147,000 people accused of offences, including violent crimes, were handed community resolutions which don't result in a criminal record. It bases its report on analysis of Ministry of Justice data. A former police officer and ex-Number 10 advisor, Rory Gagan, tells the paper that an increase in the number of knife offences has made the use of community resolutions for knife possession of particular concern.
The front page of the Times also focuses on crime, saying that police have almost entirely given up on punishing shoplifters despite the number of offences soaring. Its own analysis of official data has found 431 shoplifters were handed fixed penalty notices for thefts under the value of £100 in the year to March. The paper says this represents a 98% drop from a decade ago when more than 19,000 were issued. The Times says insiders fear the almost total lack of enforcement is encouraging further criminal behaviour.
The Daily Mail claims vital military training is being cut back to pay for what it calls salary hikes for troops. According to the paper, a £400 million shortfall means some battlefield exercises are being axed or scaled back, with soldiers being forced to pretend to shoot rather than use live ammunition. In a statement, the Ministry of Defence tells the paper that it would never compromise on the safety of personnel.
The largest aerospace and defence companies are set to rake in record levels of cash over the next 3 years, according to the Financial Times. It says they stand to benefit from a surge in government orders for new weapons amid rising geopolitical tensions. The paper says the top five US defence contractors are forecast to generate cash flow of $26 billion by the end of 2026, almost double the figure at the end of 2021.
The death of Sven-Göran Eriksson, the first foreign manager of an England football team, is widely covered on the front and back pages, indeed in the obituaries as well today. Many picture him in contemplation and highlight his words from a recent documentary on his life. Don't be sorry, smile. The Daily Express calls him a special man, while the Daily Mirror is among those who report on David Beckham's final moments with his former manager, saying, "We laughed," or Beckham saying, "We laughed, we cried, and we knew we were saying goodbye." On its back page, the Sun headline simply says, "Thanks, boss."
The time is now 11 minutes past six.
Let's turn to Ukraine. There does appear to be a significant escalation in the attacks coming from Russia towards Ukraine, in particular Kiev, which has been hit by powerful explosions for a second consecutive day. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek is in the east of Ukraine, actually in the Sumy region, which borders Russia, but can speak to us now. Nick, morning from London. Just tell us what we know about what's actually happening in Kiev at the moment, and then what the strategy might be from Moscow.
Morning, Amal. Yeah, I'm just looking at the latest alert map online for the threat of incoming Russian strikes. And a few hours ago, all of the country was in the red zone, meaning that people should be on high alert. Now it's about half, but still, we've had explosions reported in at least seven Ukrainian cities, including Kryvyi Rih, which is right in the centre of the country. And it seems that Russia is continuing this trend of hitting hotels, because it's looking like two people have been killed in a hotel, that part of which was completely obliterated. Another two reported to be missing in the rubble. Elsewhere in Zaporizhia, reports of three people killed in another strike there. And as you say, we're in the Sumy region, which borders Russia. More explosions overnight here. And this is of interest, this particular location, because it's from here that Ukraine launched that surprise incursion, of course, 3 weeks ago, taking and holding Russian territory. Meanwhile, the Kremlin says the response to that, or the punishment, as President Putin calls it, that is still to come.
And what is the situation in Sumy, though? Because, I mean, for those who don't know the geography, Nick, Sumy forms a kind of triangle with Kiev and Kharkiv. As you say, it's where Ukraine launched this offensive a few weeks ago. What's the situation where you are now? And is there any suggestion that Ukraine might try and double down on its entry into that part of Russia?
Yeah, I think that was a big question, Amal. What would the Ukrainians do? Would they retreat after taking this initial land, or would they hold it? And all the suggestions we're seeing is that they're going to be there for some time, that they are actually bringing in reinforcements, whether or not they go over the border into Russia in greater numbers, but certainly they're creating bases and trying to establish some sort of presence, sending the message that they're not going to retreat. And so all the while that happens, this is one of a number of regions, as I say, which has come under attack in the past 48 hours or so. That barrage yesterday, 127 missiles, 109 drones were sent by the Russians towards Ukraine, according to President Zelensky. And interesting, he has been saying that if you look at what's happened in the Middle East, particularly back in April, the West gathered together to create this really strong collective defense and shot down all the rockets and the missiles that were heading towards Israel. And he says, well, why can't that be applied here? That his country, Ukraine, needs a lot more support to shoot down these Russian missiles. And also he's saying once again that the Americans, the British, the French, they need to give permission so that these longer range missiles can be used, so that the Ukrainians can hit Russian targets, airfields,
yeah,
weapons stores much further into Russia to preempt the sort of stuff we've seen over the past 48 hours.
All right, Nick, plenty more I know from you across BBC platforms over the course of the day. Nick Beek in the Sumy region in East Ukraine. Thank you.
14 minutes past six. From today, callers to the NHS 111 line will be able to get through to a trained mental health professional who can then help direct them to local services in England. Hugh Pym, our health editor, joins us. How much of a difference can a change like this make, Hugh?
Well, NHS England, Michelle, say that this will make it much, much easier for people to get access to a helpline. Now, during the pandemic, many local health systems in England set up crisis helplines for mental health in their areas, but they were all different numbers and not always very easy maybe to get access to. So now there's a single point of access, NHS 111 option 2. Will take people straight through to a mental health professional, of course running alongside the existing NHS 111 service for physical illnesses and accidents. And NHS England say it's going to be one of the first of any international health system to offer this simple three-digit number to get access to this sort of service.
Are there any more resources available at the end of that, that this helpline points people to? Because just taking children alone, we were just reflecting on the Guardian analysis that says more than 500 children a day in England are being referred to NHS mental health services for anxiety.
Well, the charity Mind has made that very point, that this is a very welcome step in the right direction, because people of any age, including children, can call 111 and be put through to a mental health professional who then can guide them to the right crisis service, a drop-in centre, a crisis cafe, or maybe a visit from a professional in the field. But what really counts, they say, will be investment in mental health hospitals and community services, and that there's a danger with this sort of service that it won't have the impact that the new NHS 111 if those resources are not available. Same point being made by NHS providers representing trusts in England. And there are 2 million people who are waiting for treatment of some sort for mental health in England at the moment.
Mind will join us later on in the programme. Hugh Pym, thank you.
16 minutes past six, prices in the shops have fallen for the first time in almost 3 years, and Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Amol. Yeah, you almost got to take a breath. This is actually a fall in prices. So prices on the shelves online were 0.3% lower at the beginning of August than they were in the same period a year ago. First time we've seen some deflation, a drop in prices, since October 2021. I've got Lindsay James with me, investment strategist at Quilter Investments. Morning, Lindsay.
Good morning.
What's driving this?
Well, it's really, to be honest, I think the wet weather, it's really become from the clothing division that we're seeing these price falls coming through. And that's really been the effect of a wet summer. When we look at food, that's still rising around 2%. But to be honest, it is more muted than it was. So I think encouraging signs that inflation is coming under control. But of course, it's a reminder that this economic recovery is fragile too.
Yeah, it's on that point, isn't it, where businesses won't necessarily want to be putting their prices down year after year after year, but customers, shoppers, after all these years of price increases, might feel a bit of relief. Is this a sign of health in the economy or not?
I think it's a reminder that we do have a very competitive economy in the UK. When we look at, for example, the investigations that have been into supermarkets last year, the CMA concluded that there was a very good competitive backdrop and there hadn't been price gouging, or this term greedflation, coming through in the big companies. But I think we are starting to see those profit margins recover now a little bit more. But, you know, we have to be a little bit sensitive to the fact that growth is nevertheless a little bit fragile.
Can I ask you, changing topic, about China and its role in, well, particularly global electric vehicle sales and manufacturing of them at the moment? Canada has announced a 100% tariff, so slapping a big tax on imports of Chinese electric vehicles into Canada. And I see at the same time, headlines in the Financial Times this morning, China export curbs on semiconductor materials stoke chip output fears. So its control over all of those semiconductors that go into the likes of electric vehicles is raising concerns as well. Is there a bit of a trade war going on escalating at all here? Is that the wrong word to use?
Well, of course, there has been a trade war going on really since 2018. Now, I think we're seeing Canada playing catch up here and matching the US proposals for tariffs on EVs. But later this week, we're also going to be getting confirmation of the level of tariffs that the US will be imposing on China. There had already been proposals coming out. Now, these are very focused, and that's exactly because of the reasons you suggest that China will retaliate. So this is focused on seven key sectors. It's things like solar cells, EVs, and also some medical devices now. So I think we're going to see that expanded. But when we look at the scope of these tariffs already, it's already on around $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. And these additional tariffs from the US would only expand that by around $18 billion. So I think the US is being sensitive about that risk of China responding.
Now, another business that is has hugely impacted by what's going on in China and the strength of the Chinese economy is BHP. Big Australian mining giant listed in London as well, reported its latest results overnight. What is it telling us about demand for all of these raw materials globally and how much money it's making at the moment?
Well, they've been very clear that when they look at China, they do see some risks continuing on the horizon there. They have suggested that that demand outlook for iron ore, which is really the building blocks of the construction economy in China, that is likely to continue to be under pressure. But they're talking about an acceleration in future-facing commodities. So those are things like copper. It's really minerals that have more input into evolving renewable energy technology. So they're quite supportive still of the Chinese economy being on track to deliver official growth of 5%, despite it being quite uneven. But their results overall were very good. They had revenues up 3%, underlying profits up 2%. And I think investors were also encouraged to hear that they were retaining flexibility should another opportunity to acquire arise. So I think that potential that they might look again Anglo-American is still on the cards.
I'm going to be talking in a moment about Burberry and how the fashion giant, the British fashion giant, is getting on at the moment. And over the years, we've talked about the importance of the Chinese customer for a luxury business like that. How are you viewing the Chinese customer right now? You talk about that growth in the Chinese economy. How much of that is coming from spending by Chinese citizens?
Very little. The growth in China is really coming from their manufacturing base. And you can really see this link to the other stories we're talking about. You know, China's working hard on its export economy, partly because its consumers are so weak. Now, consumers are weak partly because they never really recovered following the COVID pandemic. And that's partly because the exposure to property in China is enormous. And when you see those property prices having declined as sharply as they have done, that has significant wealth effects. So people are being very careful at the moment in China on their spending.
Lindsay, good to talk to you. Lindsay James, investment strategist at Quilter Investments. So more on Burberry. Fashion powerhouse at one point, fallen in value so much it could actually drop out of the FTSE 100 list of the 100 biggest companies listed on the London stock markets. We'll find out about that reshuffle in the weeks to come. I've got Yelena Sokolova with me, who's the senior equity analyst at Morningstar. Hi, Yelena.
Hi.
Hi. So the share price at Burberry fallen by almost two-thirds in the past 12 months. I mean, would there be a significance of it no longer being in that premium list of companies that people can invest in on the stock markets?
Yeah, there is definitely a significance, especially with an emergence of passive indexes. Of course, Burberry will be no longer in this universe for many investors to look at.
So they won't be in that universe, but then, you know, behind the scenes, there'll be those trying to turn this business around. What are the main challenges it will have right now, if it ever wants to even get back into the FTSE 100 again, you know, if it, assuming it drops out in the weeks to come?
Yeah, exactly. So I think Burberry faces a couple of challenges. So first of all, it has been lagging luxury industry broadly kind of over the last 10 years. So one part of the weakness here, I think, is that it is still quite heavily reliant on apparel sales, which are kind of the slower growing part of luxury overall. It is also very strong in its core offering, so trench coats, but those account for just a small part of their revenue. And then they always, for the last kind of 10 years, they were trying to pivot to being a more fashion-forward house with two changes of creative leadership now, and they have also tried to push into leather goods where the environment is just super competitive with heavy hitters like LVMH and Gucci, Kering's Gucci. So that has had pretty limited success so far, and most recently also they have raised prices quite aggressively in an environment which is honestly getting much tougher for everybody, with demand being kind of weaker for luxury overall this year. So I think that's really the conundrum here.
Yelena, thank you. Interesting. Yelena Sokolova there, senior equity analyst at Morningstar. Now, more than 3,500 current and former store staff of the fashion retailer Next have won their six-year legal fight for equal pay. This is the first equal pay claim of this type against a national retailer that has succeeded. Cost to Next may be over £30 million. An employment tribunal ruled that Next failed to show that paying their sales consultants, who are overwhelmingly women, lower hourly pay rates than their warehouse operatives was not sex discrimination. Helen Scarsbrook is one of the women who were awarded compensation from Next by the court for not receiving the equivalent pay as her male colleagues.
I still really don't believe it's happened. It's absolutely incredible. I've always believed in fairness, and it doesn't seem fair that years and years after the Equal Pay Act came in, when I was actually at school, that women were still earning less than men for similar roles. And I'm a pensioner now, and it's unbelievable that we've had to wait till now for someone to actually recognise that our role is as valuable as a similar role for a man.
Liz George joins me now, lawyer with Lee Day, who successfully acted for the women in this case. Morning, Liz.
Morning.
Can you explain the significance of this moment?
Yeah, I'm just smiling listening to Helen there. Yeah, it is significant. I think you rightly said it's the first claim of this type to get to a final decision. Next aren't alone in terms of retailers where they're paying their sales assistants less than they're paying their warehouse operatives, so it has ramifications. It's taken a long time, and we had this, I think, that the law that Helen's relied on came in sort of 84. We're now 40 years later, my maths. It's huge. It's huge. I couldn't be happier.
And what are the ramifications now? If we're putting this cost to Next at maybe over £30 million, mm-hmm. I mean, Next plan to appeal, but mm-hmm. for the retail sector?
Okay, so So for these 3,500 women in this claim, they wake up this morning, some men too, of course, they wake up this morning and automatically they have contracts that are more valuable to them. So they've got their equal basic pay and they want other terms too. Going backwards, they're going to have compensation in respect because obviously they've been underpaid for previous years. They're not the only staff, of course. Next have some 22,000 sales consultants. They're going to be looking at this decision and saying, oh, what about my equal pay? So that's going to be big. And we've got all the major supermarkets with very similar claims. That's 112,000, I think, sales assistants. Similar claims, similar arguments. They'll be hugely encouraged by this.
When Next say in a statement to us that the Employment Tribunal rejected the majority of claims, in particular all claims of direct discrimination, all aspects of the claims made in respect of bonus pay, what difference does that make to maybe how you might approach future cases given that those parts were rejected?
Okay, so the store assistants had just the one claim, and that was for equal pay, and they've won that claim. I mean, there were multiple terms in the warehouses that were better than their own, and they didn't win on every single one. They didn't get equality on every single one, but they won on the ones that matter to them most. Mm. So guaranteed hourly pay, because, of course, they're all hourly paid workers, so that's the big one. I mean, when you approach these cases, what you do, you'll run all the legal arguments. You'll say, I should be getting equal pay because it's direct discrimination, or alternatively, it's indirect indirect discrimination. The lawyers get very excited about all this.
Right.
It doesn't take away from the fact that the women have won this equal pay after 6.5 years of fighting for it.
Liz, thank you. Liz George, a lawyer with Lee Day, who are acting for the women in that case.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. More from you after 7 o'clock. But now, 28 minutes past six, it's time to say good morning to Sarah with the sport. Hi, Sarah.
A very good morning to you. Right then, with the football transfer window set to close on Friday, Manchester City have agreed a £21 million deal with Saudi Pro League club Al Hilal to sell defender João Cancelo. Personal terms are not thought to be a problem, although Cancelo is yet to agree to the move. Meanwhile, midfielder Matt O'Reilly says he's happy to sign for Brighton from Scottish champion Celtic. The London-born Denmark international has signed a five-year contract until June 2029 for a fee of £25 million. And the tributes have poured in following the death of former England football manager Sven-Goran Eriksson yesterday. David Beckham described his former manager as a true gentleman and said he will be forever grateful to Eriksson. He'd revealed in January that he'd been diagnosed with cancer and given at best a year to live. The former England goalkeeper David James explained what it was like to be managed by him.
I speak for myself with conversations with other players during tournaments, during qualification games. I mean, Sven was always held in such high regard. Of course, there were tabloid stuff about off-the-field issues, but you never knew that was going on while Sven was managing the team. Again, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed my time with him.
Just one of the many tributes paid to Sven-Goran Eriksson yesterday. We'll be taking a closer look at his time as the England manager at around 8.25 this morning. You can also listen to a special Football Daily podcast, Remembering Sven-Goran Eriksson, that is available now on BBC Sounds. Tennis now, and at the US Open, there's been first round wins for defending champions Novak Djokovic and Coco Gauff. Despite losing British qualifier Jan Chomsky, Great Britain's Harriet Dart progressed to the second round, beating Chloe Paquet of France, dropping just three games along the way. Dart is being coached by her mum in New York. However, the British number three confirmed that this is certainly a temporary arrangement.
I was just joking with her. I said, we've got a quite good record, you know, Mum. Maybe you want to come a bit more. But she would never leave our family dog. So the dog is number one, definitely, out of all of us. She's missing him dearly. She FaceTimes him all the time.
The dog is called Lenny, for those that are curious. Finally, in golf, Europe's Solheim Cup captain Suzanne Pettersen says it was an obvious choice to select golfer Georgia Hall as a wildcard pick to face the United States next month. England's Hall had to rely on being one of Pettersen's four choices after failing to qualify automatically.
Sarah, thank you very much.
You murdered someone?
It wasn't me.
On BBC iPlayer.
How old were you when your brother died?
I was 15.
He was released on licence.
He killed my brother.
So naturally you're friends with him online.
He served his time. What more do you want him to do?
Some things are better laid to rest.
What were you going to get out of this?
Revenge.
Dead and buried.
How does it end?
An eye for an eye.
Watch all episodes from next Monday on BBC iPlayer.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Amol Rajan. It is 29 minutes to 7. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The Prime Minister will use a speech this morning to warn that things will get worse before they get better as he works to reverse what he'll call a decade of decline under the Conservatives. Sir Keir Starmer will deliver his message in the Rose Garden of Downing Street. Ministers hope that by being open about the need for unpopular decisions, voters will be encouraged to support them. The Conservatives say the speech is aimed at distracting the public from broken promises. Ukraine's army says Russia has launched a barrage of missile and drone attacks targeting Kyiv and other cities for a second night. Reports from the capital suggest there have been at least three rounds of explosions overnight and three people have died. The UN says new Israeli evacuation orders in Gaza have dealt a serious blow to its aid efforts, sending humanitarian workers fleeing from its operations centre in Deir al-Balah. It says the latest Israeli military order effectively upends a whole life-saving hub, affecting UN warehouses, a water desalination plant and Al-Aqsa Hospital. More than 3,500 current and former workers at Next have won the final stage of a six-year equal pay battle. An employment tribunal found a retailer had indirectly discriminated against its shop floor staff, who are mainly women. They claimed they were entitled to the same hourly pay as their largely male colleagues, who earned more working in the retailer's warehouses. Next argued it was down to market forces and the need to pay a higher going rate to recruit and retain warehouse staff. The UN Security General Antonio Guterres has warned that big polluters have a clear responsibility to cut emissions or risk a worldwide catastrophe. Speaking from Tonga, he said ocean temperatures were rising in the Pacific Islands at three times the rate worldwide, and that its population was uniquely exposed to the impact of rising sea levels. And prices in the shops are falling for the first time in nearly 3 years. The British Retail Consortium says shop prices this month were 0.3% lower than a year earlier. It's thought retailers have been cutting prices to shift summer stock, especially for fashion and household goods.
Alan, thank you very much. It is just after 6:30. Now, in the end of the August bank holiday brings an end of summer feel with it. Today, the Prime Minister will make a speech in Downing Street in which he will speak of Labour inheriting not only an economic black hole, but a societal black hole. Nick Eardley, our political correspondent, joins us. What would you say is the purpose of this speech today, Nick?
I think two things, Michelle. Clearly, Keir Starmer is trying to set the scene for the return of Parliament next week, when the real work for this government will start. I think he's trying to do two things. One is to draw a line under previous governments by insisting this isn't business as usual, that this is a government back in service of working people. He's using the Rose Garden in Downing Street as a non too subtle way of saying, think of the things that happened here during lockdown with the wine and cheese party. Well, I'm going to do it very differently. Secondly, though, and something that we've heard battered on the airwaves by Labour ministers over the last few weeks, is to try and be realistic. We're going to hear that message of tough choices and tough decisions coming, saying that that things are going to get harder before they get easier. Clearly, Keir Starmer trying to say, this is what I want politics, how I want politics to be framed over the next few months. But as we've seen over the summer, that framing isn't always in the hands of the government, and already the new number 10 is facing some pretty significant pressure points.
You mean over decisions like the winter fuel payments, the reduction of winter fuel payments for most pensioners, especially now that we know energy bills are going to go up?
That's the biggest one. We know that there are an increasing number of Labour politicians uncomfortable with that decision, worried about the message it sends. I do know that the Treasury is looking at potentially extending the hardship fund, which gives councils in England extra cash to give people who are struggling with the cost of living. That is one mitigation that the Treasury is actively exploring for the budget at the end of October. But I don't think that pressure on winter fuel payment is going to go away, although I don't think the Prime Minister is going to budge on it when he's asked about it inevitably at that press conference later. But there are also, aren't there, those pressures over allegations of cronyism. The significant Labour donor, Lord Ali, who had a Downing Street pass, that's caused some consternation in Westminster, a lot of questions for the Prime Minister on that. But at the same time as he's facing questions on that, he's going to try and say today, this is a completely new type of government that's going to do things differently. Just one example of how Downing Street are trying to illustrate that, confirmed this morning that a £40 million helicopter contract that was due to be renewed is being scrapped by the new government because it's not seen as value for money.
Nick Eardley, thank you.
23 minutes to seven, let's turn to events in the Middle East with our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, who's in Jerusalem. Yolande, a couple of things wanted to run through with you. The first is what the situation is in terms of aid, because as we understand it, aid operations ground to a halt in Gaza yesterday. And then we'll come on to what's happening in the West Bank, where there's been an Israeli airstrike and five people have been killed. But let's do aid first. What has happened? What is the situation in terms of the UN being able to get aid in?
Well, I've been trying to get an update from senior UN officials who've been speaking to journalists who were saying late yesterday that they had been unable to carry out any aid deliveries because of the conditions that they were in, that they had not, in effect, been operating in Gaza yesterday and questioning where they should move to now. This is because there's this main UN operations centre in Deir al-Balah, in the centre of the Gaza Strip. The UN relocated there after Israel's military moved into Rafah back in May. That's where operations were previously. And, you know, when these military evacuation orders came through, the latest ones, we've had really a quick succession of these military evacuation orders in recent days. We were told that staff had sort of, you know, had to hurry away so quickly that they hadn't been able to take some vital equipment with them. This is an area where they say there are 15 premises affected by one of the latest orders, and these host UN NGO aid workers, 4 UN warehouses, the Al-Aqsa Hospital, 2 clinics, 3 wells, a water reservoir and a desalination plant, all either in or near to this designated area. So this had been seen as a kind of life-saving humanitarian hub, but now it's not able to function. And of course, so many people displaced by the fighting across Gaza have ended up in Deir al-Balah, where there's now an Israeli military operation going on that hasn't really seen a full Israeli ground offensive up to this point. I did ask the Israeli military for comment on this and the humanitarian situation. They haven't yet got back to me.
And in terms of the West Bank, Yolande, I'm just looking at the BBC copy. It looks like 5 people have been killed. There's been an Israeli airstrike there on a refugee camp. The IDF, as we understand, have confirmed the strike. What are the IDF saying about why that was targeted?
I mean, they're simply saying that it was an operations centre for Palestinian militants in this urban refugee camp, which is close to Tulkarm. We're told by Palestinian media that 2 children are among those who have been killed. And at the same time, there's been close to Bethlehem in the south of the West Bank, a Palestinian who has been killed, 3 others wounded, shot dead by Israeli settlers, according to what Palestinian medics are saying. The Israeli military is saying it's looking into those reports. And of course, this comes as we've really seen a surge in extremist settler violence in the West Bank since the start of the war in Gaza, with settlers also taking over more and more land. We had even last week the head of Israel's domestic intelligence service, Ronan Bar, sending a letter to ministers, which was leaked to the media, where he warned that Jewish extremists in the West Bank were, in his words, carrying out acts of terror against Palestinians and causing, he said, indescribable damage to the country.
Yolande, now in Jerusalem. Thank you very much indeed.
22-7. Thankfully, no one died in the huge fire that broke out at a block of flats in East London yesterday, but there are significant questions about whether cladding on the building might have played a role. Tom Simons, our correspondent, is at the site now. What does it look like this morning, Tom?
Well, it's a sorry state, really. A building that's been badly damaged by fire, and they are still, more than 24 hours on after the fire, pumping tons of water onto the roof of this building, giving you an idea of the effort required to make sure it is safe. All the roads around here have very, very long runs of hoses, which they're obviously bringing in water from all over the place to pump into this building. And as you say, questions about the material that was used to clad the building when it was built about 7 years ago. I've been looking at some of the planning documents for the work to replace that cladding with safer cladding, and it looks as if, we don't know what was on the building, nothing's been confirmed, but it looks as if it was a type of what's called HPL, which is a type of laminated cladding that has in the past failed fire tests and been shown to be flammable, which is why it was being removed. And of course, we don't know at this stage whether that job had been completed, partially completed, or hadn't been started. The scaffolding is up to do the work, but we don't know how far they had got.
We're going to explore this issue later on in the programme, Tom, about the number of buildings still 7 years on from the Grenfell Tower, which appear to continue to have risky cladding or dangerous cladding on them. Is it this question of who pays for removal that's why the process hasn't been completed yet?
Well, the government has pumped quite a lot of money into this, but there's quite a lot of moving parts when you look at the... It's about 4,600 buildings around the country that need some kind of work because they've got unsafe cladding. According to the latest government figures, about 50% of those buildings had had work started or had work completed. So that clearly leaves the other 50% where work hasn't started yet. It's partly the money. It's partly making sure that building owners take responsibility for the work that needs to be done. And it's partly the practical difficulties of taking a building, putting up scaffolding, putting up the kind of climbing devices that are needed to get work people up to the top and bottom of the building, replacing all the cladding, making sure that all sorts of other work is done, as well as the cladding, removing cladding. For example, there might be other materials that need attention to. And of course, all of that is very disruptive for residents who don't enjoy that experience. So this is a major, major problem. And it continues, really, more than 7 years on from Grenfell. And the report into the Grenfell fire, the final report of the inquiry, is due next week.
Tom Simons, thank you.
17 minutes to 7, brief overview of what's going on in some of the papers. And many, many of the front pages carry the face of one man smiling, the beaming face of Sven-Göran Eriksson, the former football manager of England, England's first ever foreign manager who died yesterday, of course. And as so often, if you read the obituaries, you find so much of the best writing there. And you find, you learn things about someone you thought you knew but had no idea about. So it turns out Sven-Göran Eriksson was born into something akin to real poverty. His dad was a bus driver. His mum worked in a textile shop and a kiosk. I'm reading in the Telegraph obituary on page 25. He left school soon after he started playing for the local football team at 16, did military service, found a job with the state insurance agency, but tired of this, became economics and then a PE teacher and really became a football manager quite by accident. What an extraordinary life. And if you fancy reading about it, some very good obituaries around in the papers today.
Two of the papers focus on crime stories as their dominant ones this morning. The Telegraph says more than 147,000 people accused of offences including sex crimes, violence and weapons possession were handed community resolutions in the year to March instead of being prosecuted. Such resolutions do not result in a criminal record. Police guidance says they should be restricted to low-level crimes with offenders required to apologise to the victim, accept responsibility and offer some form of recompense. But the resolutions, which are issued at the discretion of individual police officers, have increased by 40% since 2019. The Telegraph's discovered this according to an analysis of Ministry of Justice data, and it says it comes amid a deepening crisis in the criminal justice system. The Times, meanwhile, focuses on shoplifting, saying police officers have almost entirely ceased pursuing shoplifters despite the number of offences soaring to record levels.
At 7:15, our main headline this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is to give a major speech in Downing Street's Rose Garden later today, pledging to reverse a decade of decline in the UK. But the Conservatives say the speech is aimed at distracting the public from broken government promises.
A crisis entirely of humanity's making is how the UN Secretary General is describing climate change as he speaks to Pacific Island leaders in Tonga. The region faces a triple threat, experts say: warming waters, a rise in sea levels and growing acidity because of carbon dioxide. From Tonga, our correspondent Katie Watson reports.
Is in the spotlight this week. Leaders from the 18 members that make up the Pacific Islands Forum, from small island nations like Kiribati to larger countries, Australia and New Zealand. They're all here to discuss the region, its vulnerabilities and its priorities. But as the opening ceremony took place on Monday morning, some delegates struggled to even reach the venue on time because of the weather.
Since I got here, it has not stopped raining, as you can probably here. It is absolutely tipping it down. The venue is drenched. There was even an earthquake earlier and delegates had to be evacuated from one of the buildings. And walking between venues, there's no public transport, taxis, so I'm wading through the streets to get from one area to another. So it's very much all of the vulnerability that the Pacific is talking about in action on a very important week.
The Pacific is today the most vulnerable area in the world. And there is an enormous injustice in relation to the Pacific, and that is the reason why I'm here.
This is the second time United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has attended the forum. Climate change is an important issue for him, and his warnings come as new data from the UN shows how rising sea levels are picking up pace and threatening Pacific islands more than ever.
First, they do not contribute at all to climate change. Second, they are in the first line of the impacts of climate change. I was in several coastal areas of the two islands that I visited, and I've seen how the sea level rise together with the storms is forcing people to leave to other places and is undermining the economy and the society. Everything that is happening today as a threat in climate change is multiplied in the Pacific Islands, and so they face a real existential threat.
Now at this meeting this week, you've got mostly small Pacific Islands. You also have the likes of Australia, New Zealand, big donors, also big emitters. And many people here are very angry with the likes of Australia. They've said they're going to ramp up gas expansion to 2050 and beyond. It flies in the face of wanting to help their friends in the Pacific. What message do you have for Australia?
Sea level rise is accelerating. But we know that if the temperature rises more than what's happening now, there is a risk of tipping points. So we could witness, all of a sudden, a dramatic acceleration of sea level rise. And this is something that we must avoid at all costs. And so there is an obligation of all developed countries and all emerging economies, the G20, that represent 80% of the emissions, there is an obligation for them to come together, guarantee a reduction of emissions, and a reduction of emissions now.
Not far from the venue, there's a street parade taking place. Dancers representing many of the Pacific Islands. There's one big banner saying, "We're not drowning, we're fighting." Another reads, "The sea level's rising, so are we." Joseph Sekulu is from Tonga and is the Pacific Director at 350, a climate change advocacy group.
Climate change is one of those things that's just going to exacerbate all the disasters that we already feel. And so it's important to always ground these conversations in that kind of reality, and important for leaders, especially like Australia, to come and witness these things for themselves, but also witness the resilience of our people. And a core part of Tongan culture is our ability to be able to continue to be joyful throughout our adversity. And that's how we practice our resilience. And to see and witness that, I think, is going to be important for everybody.
These populations may be small, but their voices are getting louder. All the while, the threats to their very existence getting bigger.
That's Katie Watson reporting from Tonga, and the time is 10 to 7. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are scheduled to meet for a live presidential TV debate in 2 weeks. But ahead of it, the two campaign teams are sparring over the rules and whether microphones will remain live throughout. I asked John Sudworth, our North America correspondent, what was happening.
Both candidates see the stakes as being very high. For Donald Trump, seen by many to have lost something of his momentum in this election campaign, it's a chance to regain ground in an unscripted format that he thrives on. And for Kamala Harris, it's a chance to show she's more than just words on a teleprompter, having, you know, so far at least, been almost totally untested. No big media interviews, no press conference, etc., since she became the Democratic Party's nominee. So both need this event to make their mark, to try and gain that advantage in the polls, and yet the wrangling over the terms and conditions continue. Mr. Trump has suggested that he may now pull out because ABC, the host network, is, he says, biased against him. Is that an empty threat? Hard to know. And Ms. Harris's team is suggesting she wants the rules changed so that both candidates' mics remain on throughout the proceedings. And that is because they believe, it's quite clear, that for her, that will better help to expose Donald Trump's erratic, impulsive side.
So she thinks she will come across better when he interrupts a lot. She will hit back, or she will rise above it and look more presidential as a result?
A little bit of both. You know, her campaign have made a lot of the fact that she is a former prosecutor that she, you know, has proven herself in the Senate, for example, quite good under pressure. These sort of kind of cross-examination type set-piece political events. So I think that's exactly what they're hoping for. In the last presidential debate, with a very different candidate, of course, the Joe Biden-Donald Trump presidential debate back in June, the mics were muted when either candidate was not speaking. So only the person who had the floor had their mic turned on. And there were questions then, would that work to Donald Trump's advantage? In the end, it didn't matter, of course, because the only thing that came out of that debate was, of course, the sudden end of Joe Biden's candidacy. It exposed him as, you know, in terms of his age and his frailty. But I think the Harris campaign believes clearly, they're saying as much publicly, that having those mics live, having those mics hot, as they say, would be to her advantage.
John Sudworth, thank you.
7 minutes to seven. Well, earlier in this hour, we spoke to Nick Beek, our correspondent in Sumy in the east of Ukraine, about the situation in that war between Russia and Ukraine. Let's get an update on it and try and put it into a broader context and understand what's going on in that war with Professor Michael Clark, renowned defence analyst and a former director general of RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
We've spoken so much, I'm going to call you Michael rather than Professor Clark, which I tend to, if that's all right.
I prefer Michael.
Thank you. Let's just bring our listeners up to date. So what's happening at the moment is Russia has launched several waves of missile and drone attacks targeting several different Ukrainian regions. At least four people have died. Why is Russia doing that? And is it a response to that recent Ukrainian incursion?
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, yesterday there looked to be about 230-odd drones and missiles launched, and we haven't got a count on what's coming overnight, but probably it'll be of that order. Undoubtedly, I think the Russians, from a tactical point of view, are trying to overwhelm Ukrainian air defences by launching probably, you know, 80 or 100 missiles and another 100 or so drones. That's what they did yesterday. And undoubtedly, this is Putin's attempt to, as it were, regain the narrative to show that this is Russian momentum, and that the Russians have got every intention and the capability of making life miserable for the Ukrainians over the winter by attacking their infrastructure. It's already very badly damaged. There's already power cuts and water shortages in some cities. And the Russians intend to make that into a crisis once the winter starts. And of course, the weather is pretty predictable in Ukraine. So come the last week of October, first week of November, it will start to get cold.
Because I was going to say, I mean, the psychology of this as we head into winter is that, I mean, I remember talking to you, I think, on this program a couple of years ago about how Ukrainian winters can be very, very harsh. This is about making Ukrainians think they're in for an extremely rough ride, potentially the nastiest winter that they've faced since this war began.
Yes, I mean, this will be the third winter. The first one wasn't really too bad. The second one last year, the Ukrainians got through it with a fair bit of Western help. And I think the Russians calculate that Western help will not be so forthcoming in this winter. And I mean, the nature of the climate itself, whether it's a harsh winter or not, will have something to do with it. And also, I mean, the Russians, they go for civilian populations. It's what they do. It's what they did in Syria. It's what they do in Georgia. They attack the civilian population in every way they can think of. And in this case, I think there's some evidence that they're now targeting hotels.
Yes, what's
that
about?
So it looks as if they also want to go for foreigners.
Well, why hotels? Why would they go for foreigners and indeed journalists who stay there? I mean, what's it about? Is that trying to create a sort of a terror that makes the war feel even more dangerous to cover?
Exactly that. I mean, in a sense that the idea that they think they've got the frighteners on the West, and I think there's some truth in that. And by making the war seem more dangerous, then they actually make it seem more serious, and they think that they're worrying the West more. And of course, it will have a dual effect. In some respects, it may make some Western powers more determined to help Ukraine, and it may make the Ukrainians more determined to hold out. But equally, it does have some effect in some societies. I mean, look at debates in Germany. I mean, the German public are genuinely frightened, I think, largely by what's going on in Ukraine. And certainly the German political establishment is pretty frightened at the moment.
It's interesting you mentioned politics, Michael. Final thought. Is this a war that is won militarily, or is it in the end a war that, because of the Western support for Ukraine, in the end, it's not going to be won by a decisive military action? In the end, it's going to be some sort of political settlement.
Yes. I mean, in the end, there will be some temporary peace, but that peace ought to be, by most standards in the West, on as advantageous terms as possible for the Ukrainians. I mean, to be honest, if the Russians lost all of the territory that they had taken since February 2022, I mean, that wouldn't satisfy Ukraine, but that would look pretty good to the backers in the West. They'd settle for that because the ultimate end of this would be that Putin had failed and had paid a huge price for it. That would feel like victory in the West, even if it didn't feel like victory in Kyiv.
Professor Michael Clark, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
The weather now with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Michelle. Yeah, we've got some pretty wet weather moving its way in today across northern and western parts of the UK with some blustery winds and a pretty breezy day even across the east and southeast of England, where this morning it's pretty mild. We've got some sunshine and that sunshine is going to continue into the afternoon. It's going to be warmer than yesterday. Temperatures typically about 22 or 23, but we could see highs of about 25 or 26 Celsius in parts of East Anglia and the southeast. For southwest England and the Midlands, generally a fairly bright start today with some sunny spells, but the cloud will thicken in western areas where there's a chance of a bit of rain in the far southwest later in the day, turning quite breezy, temperatures of 18 to 23 Celsius. Now for Wales, northwest and northeast England, pretty blustery with some pretty strong gusts of wind around coastal areas, dry with some sunny spells this morning, but turning pretty overcast really by lunchtime as rain spreads into the west. That rain turning really quite heavy in some parts with those blustery winds continuing, temperatures of 17 to 21. For Northern Ireland, a mild start, rain moving through pretty quickly to bring some sunny spells and blustery winds. And for Scotland, very wet at the moment, some surface water spray, some puddles out there, strong winds, rain moving south and east with clearing off with some sunshine in northern areas later.
Simon, thank you very much. And now here's John Wilson.
This Cultural Life, where guests reveal the most significant cultural influences on their creativity.
To this day, I am still terrified of Bill Sykes. Usually, if I speak about him long enough, you will start to see the goose pimples.
In the new series, the novelist Marlon James and the opera star Dame Kiri Takanawa.
I sing in the car a lot. Keeps me awake because I sing along with Barry White. And I don't mind Amy Winehouse either.
And we'll hear from the crime novelist, Lee Child.
David and Goliath was no doubt bought at a jumble sale. I read it, but I loved Goliath. Goliath was my favourite.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts this Thursday morning at 11.
Well, last night, the Paralympic gold medalist Dame Tanny Gray-Thompson had a pretty dreadful ordeal trying to get off a train in London's King's Cross. We'll be speaking to her in the coming hour.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of August. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer is to use a speech at Downing Street to promise to get a grip on the UK's problems, but will warn that things will get worse before they get better. Russia has carried out more heavy drone and missile strikes across Ukraine overnight. Several people have been killed. And NHS England is offering a 24-hour mental health phone line for adults and children. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Prime Minister will promise to reverse a decade of decline when he delivers a speech in the Rose Garden of Downing Street later. But he'll also warn that things will get worse before they get better. Sir Keir Starmer will say this summer's riots didn't just betray the sickness in society, but also revealed the cure to work together to fix the foundation for the long term. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
Speaking before Parliament returns next week, Sir Keir Starmer will say it won't be business as usual. No more division and distraction, no more politics of performance. He will deliver this message in the Downing Street Rose Garden in front of 50 people he met during the election campaign, from small business owners to firefighters. Promising a government of service, Sir Keir will say rooting out 14 years of rot under the Conservatives will take hard work and time, that things will get worse before they get better. Downing Street hopes that by being frank about the scale of the challenge and flagging the need for unpopular decisions, voters will be on board. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has already warned that repairing the public finances is likely to mean some tax rises in her autumn budget. The Conservatives dismiss the speech as a performative attempt to distract the public from promises they claimed Sir Keir Starmer never had any intention of keeping.
At least four people are reported to have been killed in Ukraine in a second consecutive night of Russian air attacks. Explosions have been heard in several cities, including the capital, Kyiv. Yesterday, Russia launched one of its biggest attacks on Ukraine since the start of the war, damaging critical infrastructure. Our correspondent Nick Beek has sent this report from Ukraine's Sumy region, which borders Russia.
For a second morning, the sirens wailed as Russian missiles closed in. Blasts have been reported in at least 7 cities, including Kryvyi Rih, where a woman was killed in a strike that obliterated part of a hotel. Explosions have been heard again in the capital Kyiv as air defence kicked in. The huge barrage that Moscow fired at Ukraine yesterday has been condemned by President Biden as outrageous. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, described it as cowardly. President Zelensky said Western allies must do more to protect Ukraine from drones and missiles, noting that a collective effort in the Middle East had successfully protected Israel from a huge aerial attack. Ukraine is also urging partners to allow it to use longer-range missiles to strike weapons stores and airfields deeper inside Russia to try to stop more of the aerial bombardments we've seen in the past 48 hours.
The UN says that new Israeli evacuation orders in Gaza have dealt a serious blow to its aid efforts, sending humanitarian workers fleeing from its operations centre. At the same time, violence has flared in the occupied West Bank, where medics say one Palestinian was shot dead by an Israeli settler and 5 others were killed in an Israeli airstrike. With the latest from Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell.
Aid operations ground to a halt in Gaza yesterday, a senior UN official said, with UN staff having to evacuate their operations centre in Deir al-Balah so quickly that essential equipment was left behind. The UN's humanitarian office says that the latest Israeli military order effectively upends the whole life-saving hub, affecting UN warehouses, a water desalination plant and Al-Aqsa Hospital. The order was given as the UN prepares to begin a mass vaccination program for polio after the first case in 25 years was found in Gaza. In the West Bank, the Israeli military says its aircraft struck a base for armed fighters in an urban refugee camp near Tulkarm. Amid a recent surge in violence by extremist settlers, it said it was looking into reports of a deadly settler raid near Bethlehem.
The UN Secretary-General has said big polluters have a clear responsibility to cut emissions or risk a worldwide catastrophe. Antonio Guterres gave the warning on a visit to the Pacific Island nation of Tonga, which is especially vulnerable to the effects of climate change. He spoke to our correspondent Katie Watson.
Speaking to the BBC, Mr. Guterres said there was an enormous injustice in the Pacific. The small islands don't contribute to climate change, he said, but everything that happens because of climate change is multiplied here. And global average sea levels are rising at rates unprecedented in the past 3,000 years. The situation is crazy, said Mr. Guterres. It's a crisis, he warned, would soon swell to an almost unimaginable scale, with, as he said, no lifeboat to take us back to safety. The UN Secretary General said that the only way of preventing catastrophe was to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. But to do that, the world needs to cut emissions by 43% compared to 2019 by 2030. Last year, emissions rose 1%. It's time to say enough, said Mr. Guterres. Big emitters have a clear responsibility to reverse the current trend.
Investigators are trying to find out what caused a fire at a tower block in Dagenham in East London. More than 80 people were evacuated from the building in the early hours of yesterday morning. 2 were taken to hospital. The fire service has said the building had known safety issues and the role cladding played in the blaze would form part of the investigation. Patients experiencing a mental health crisis in England will now be able to get direct support by calling NHS 111. Health leaders say the system will be one of the first internationally to offer round-the-clock mental health support through a 3-digit helpline. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
During the pandemic, local mental health crisis helplines were set up in many areas, but now there'll be a single point of access to these support services via NHS 111. People of all ages, including children, will be able to call and select an option to speak to a trained mental health professional. They can then be guided to appropriate services, including local drop-in centres and cafes run by mental health support workers. NHS England said the aim was to make it as easy as possible for people to reach services if they were in crisis. The facility will run alongside what's already available via 111 for physical illnesses and accidents. The charity Mind said it was a sensible step, but argued that the impact could be limited if there wasn't substantial investment in mental health hospitals and community services.
More than 3,500 current and former workers at Next have won the final stage of a long-running battle for equal pay. The case centred on whether shop floor staff, mainly women, are entitled to the same hourly pay as their largely male colleagues who earn more working in the retailers' warehouses. An employment tribunal found the retailer had indirectly discriminated against the claimants. Here's our business correspondent Emma Simpson.
This case has taken 6 years. First, the store staff had to prove their roles were comparable to their colleagues working in Next warehouses. Then they had to prove their work was of equal value. Finally, an employment tribunal had to decide whether there was any reason other than sex discrimination why they were being paid less. Next argued it was down to market forces and the need to pay a higher going rate to recruit and retain warehouse staff. But the tribunal ruled that wasn't enough of a defence, although it didn't uphold the claims of direct discrimination. Lawyers for the mainly female store workers said the average loss of salary was £6,000 for the period of the claim, and that the bill for compensation could top £30 million. Next says it's now planning to appeal, saying there are important legal principles at stake.
Prices in shops are falling for the first time in nearly 3 years. The British Retail Consortium says shop prices this month were 0.3% lower than a year earlier. It's thought retailers have been cutting prices to shift summer stock, especially for fashion and household goods. And there's an expectation this morning that Oasis are about to announce a reunion. It's been 15 years since the band split up after the brothers Liam and Noel Gallagher fell out. But in recent days, both have teased an announcement for today through cryptic posts on social media.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. Just coming up to 7:09. Things will get worse before they get better is the line that's been briefed out about Sir Keir Starmer's big speech today in the Rose Garden of Downing Street. A nod, perhaps, to impending tax rises or spending cuts or both. Sir Keir and Labour have recently argued they will need a decade to fix the economic and social inheritance they have. Labour was founded as the parliamentary representation of the working class with trade unions to the fore. What do they make of his argument and Labour's start in power? Well, Paul Novak is General Secretary of the TUC and has come in to join us in the studio. Paul, good to see you. Thanks for coming
in. Good morning.
This is a classic rolling the pitch speech, isn't it? So there's what Keir Starmer is saying explicitly, and then there's what he's more sort of saying implicitly about tax, about spending and so forth. What do you think is his real message today?
Well, I think he's absolutely right, first of all, to just foreground that the government is inheriting a rotten mess from the previous Conservative administration. Whether you look at the state of the nation's finances, the state of our public services, I would struggle to think of one public service that is better now than it was 14 years ago. So I think he's right to warn that there are no quick fixes. This isn't an overnight job. But that actually this is a government that is serious about getting to the heart of some of those deep-rooted problems, getting the UK economy growing again, getting more money into people's pockets, raising living standards, and starting that long, hard job of repairing our public services. So a serious message, I think, from a serious Prime Minister that his government is committed to putting right what went wrong over the last 14 years.
I think they'll be delighted to hear you speaking so effusively about them. Let's turn to some of the pay deals that have been struck with various unions. It's important, of course, to say different unions have got different positions. Yep. Labour have said they'll agree to the recommendations of most independent pay review bodies. Does that satisfy you, or do you want them to go further and say no to all wage restraints?
No, I think it was really important that the government accepted in full the recommendations of those pay review bodies. Unions are now consulting their members about whether or not members feel that that's gone far enough. But I think it was the right thing to do. The previous government, and I criticised them a lot about hiding behind the pay review bodies, playing fast and loose with the recommendations of the pay review bodies. So Labour accepting those recommendations in full, I think, was an important step forward.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be rational for you to respond to that by saying, well, they've gone that far, we'll go a little bit further?
Well, listen, for public sector workers, whether it's nurses or teachers or people working in the civil service, they've had a decade now or more of real terms pay cuts. And I think, you know, in the longer term, they are going to be looking for decent pay rises. That's going to be essential if we're going to solve the recruitment and retention crisis in our public services. But as I say, unions are now consulting their members about those offers. I think it's a good first step. We all have a shared interest in making sure that we solve the staffing crisis in our classrooms, in our hospitals, 300,000 vacancies alone, staffing vacancies in the NHS and social care. And you can't fix those problems by holding down the pay of the of public sector workers, as the previous government found out.
No doubt, lots of public services face very big problems. But I just want to understand your thinking, because a lot of people would say that you had a tough negotiation with the previous Conservative government. There weren't resolutions in lots of cases. Strikes took place. The new Labour government has come in. They've accepted some of the recommendations of these pay review bodies. And some people would say, well, that's actually weakness from the government. And the rational thing for you as a negotiator to do would be to say, well, they've buckled, and therefore we want to push them even further, and we're going to go hard at them, and we're going to say we want even bigger rises.
I don't think it's a case of weakness or buckling. I think it's a case of respecting the findings of those pay review bodies, recognising the public sector workers have had a difficult time over the last few years, and recognising also this is the first step towards repairing our public services. And at the heart of that has got to be the staff who deliver those services.
But do you want them to say no to wage restraint?
But I always want more for our members and to be ambitious on behalf of working people. But obviously, unions are now actively consulting the members about those offers. It'll be down to members about whether or not they feel that's enough this year. But in the medium term, we've got to work together, unions, governments, public sector employers, to think about how we do resolve these recruitment and retention issues and put right our public service.
In the run-up to the election, the Labour Party ruled out raising taxes on working people. That was the formulation they used, whatever it may mean. They said no tax rises on the big ones, national insurance, income tax, VAT, etc. Would you prefer they hadn't done that?
No, I mean, I can well understand if you're a teacher or a supermarket worker, you would be very wary about any tax rises, particularly as we emerge from a cost of living crisis. So I think the Prime Minister is right to promise no tax rises on working people. I think what will be interesting at the budget, and obviously we'll have to see this in the round, is that clearly we've said at the TUC there needs to be a national conversation about tax in this country. Now, the government has already set out some practical measures, more resources for HMRC to close the tax gap, VAT on private school fees, clamping down on the non-doms. I think that there's scope to think about things like, for example, equalising capital gains tax with income tax. I can't see why it's right for somebody who derives their income from shares or property to pay a lesser tax rate than someone who goes out to work each and every single day. So I think there are things the government will be looking at. As I say, I think from our members' perspective, absolutely right to sort of give people that commitment, a little bit of reassurance that they're not going to be hit by tax rises.
Paul Novak, General Secretary of the TUC, thank you for coming in.
Thanks very much.
14 minutes past seven is the time. From today, just as the NHS 111 service can direct you to A&E or arrange for a doctor or nurse to speak to you, it will also be able to connect people in need of help with mental health to a trained professional. Here's how Claire Murdoch, Mental Health Director for NHS England, has described the new service.
We're working flat out as the NHS to try and meet demand, but it would be wrong to suggest that we don't still have our challenges. I think what I want to convey, though, is if people have a mental health problem, if they are in crisis, we've just taken another huge step forward by introducing 111, who can put you through to your local crisis lines.
Well, Dr. Sarah Hughes is Chief Executive of the mental health charity Mind. Good morning, Dr. Hughes.
Good morning.
What's your understanding of how it will work?
So I was very fortunate to be part of one of the early pilots in Cambridge and Peterborough, the second region to develop this service. So effectively, people call up if they're in mental health crisis. They will be greeted by a specialist team trained to triage and to support people at their most vulnerable, and they will work out what to do next. And for some people, it could be as simple as referring and signposting to community services. For other people, we will be arranging crisis support. For other people, it might be more emergency response and, you know, sending ambulances, taking people to hospital and so on.
But that kind of support, the help via a phone line, was already available, wasn't it? Didn't local health trusts already operate these phone lines? Is the real change here the fact that it's through a single phone number rather than having to find your local NHS mental health helpline?
Indeed. This creates one national front door, effectively. We know that when people are in deep crisis, the worst thing is scrabbling around trying to find out who to call, you know, how to get help that you might need. And this really kind of cuts out the middleman and allows you to kind of get straight to the people that can help you.
But what is the difference between that mental health professional who won't necessarily be a mental health nurse or a doctor trained in this area, will there? Is there really a kind of triage help that will be possible now that wasn't under other people you would reach through 111?
Yes, I mean, I think I can understand the question. I mean, the reality is that the people that will be on the 111 mental health crisis line will be trained individuals. They won't be nurses and doctors, of course, but they will be people who will be equipped to deal with people in the most difficult crisis for their mental health. So I think they'll still get the help that they need. They won't necessarily get all of the help that they need. The issue for us is really about accessing services in the long term. But certainly this allows people to get access to the help that they need more quickly, for sure.
Well, if it's available, because isn't the point that you might well find when you get through to a service you're on a waiting list?
Yes, I mean, that's the stark reality of the mental health landscape at the moment. We can't meet demand. And so this service isn't going to resolve all of those problems, but it will get people to somebody who can listen. You know, it might be able to speed up access to support. So, you know, what we want people to do is, if they are in mental health crisis, to be able to call this line. We don't want people to think that they won't get the help that they need. In many instances, they will get the help that they need.
Dr. Sarah Hughes from Mind, thank you very much. And the NHS, just to reiterate, says that this is a new integrated service which is available to patients of all ages, including children, who need to speak to someone urgently.
18 minutes past seven. More now on the news that prices have been falling in the shops. Sean Farrington has the boss of one of our biggest toy stores with him. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Amal. Yeah, apologies to parents listening with kids who are hearing about toys costing less. All these figures are from the British Retail Consortium, showing that despite food prices increasing, overall prices fell 0.3% at the beginning of August compared to last year. And that's because of a big fall in all the stuff we're buying that isn't food. Andrew Murphy is the chief executive of The Entertainer. He's got 165 stores across the UK, plenty of concessions in the likes of Tesco and M&S as well. Andrew, morning.
Morning, Sean.
Why have you seen prices falling?
Well, two factors in the main. Some of the underlying cost pressures that we've been battling along with other retailers for the last 18 months have started to ease just a little. So, for example, freight costs, which were running at well over double the long-run average, have started to come off just a little bit, meaning that we've got a bit more capacity to offer great prices and promotions to customers. But also the fact that, in our case, we are a price-promoting retailer, and every week, every day that you come into an Entertainer store or go online to the Entertainer, you'll find a price-led promotion to try and encourage customers in and kids to shop.
But for so much of the last few years, when we've heard about price pressures upwards, it's been because of major things occurring in your supply chain, whether it's energy costs or container costs. Are those pressures easing so much? Is this telling us that the health of retailers is improving?
Well, look, I think the overall figures that have been reported by the BRC aren't actually a story of health necessarily, because I think they talk to some unseasonal weather over the summer, meaning that fashion retailers, who create a big account for a big amount of the numbers being talked about, have had to cut price to clear stock. In terms of the underlying cost inflation, you know, the biggest cost that we have as a business that isn't the products that we buy in order to sell is labour, is wage cost, and that's moved up by around 10% this year as the national living wage has increased, and that one will continue to grow.
And just,
freight costs.
Just on that one, sorry, Andrew, to interrupt you, just because we haven't got a lot of time, but I just wonder, with the Prime Minister talking later today about apparently how things are going to be getting worse before they get better, do you expect more costs to be coming your way from the government?
I think it's certainly possible. They've made it clear that they're looking at employment legislation and want to be active there. We've been engaging with them for some time before they came into government to try and make sure that they avoid unintended consequences that stifle growth and actually mean that employers, particularly in retail, find it more difficult to create and sustain jobs. And it's very easy to be well-intentioned in this space, but actually create more problems than you solve.
Andrew Murphy, thank you, Chief Executive of The Entertainer.
Sean, thank you. 21 minutes past seven. Aid distribution in Gaza is at a standstill this morning, the UN has said, with its staff and other aid workers forced to move quickly out of buildings they live and work from amid the latest evacuation orders from the Israeli army. Israel says such orders are aimed at protecting civilians as it continues to battle Hamas. Agencies have repeatedly called for a ceasefire. Louise Wattridge is from the UN agency UNRWA and spoke to us from Gaza an hour ago.
I'm in an area just outside of the recent evacuation orders, but what has happened is our other UN agencies here have had to move from their accommodation. They've had to move from their offices and their headquarters. So they have now joined us in this area just outside of the recent evacuation orders. And it's been completely disruptive to the humanitarian response on the ground. You know, if the humanitarians are having to move themselves, they're not able to work. Operations have to halt while they relocate, while they reestablish, or, you know, their work on the ground.
How frequent or infrequent are orders affecting premises like the UN's? Because I would imagine that all of these are marked and identified, aren't they, as protected buildings?
Yes, all of the facilities we work from are deconflicted. What that means is we share coordinates on a daily basis with Israeli authorities to let them know where we're working, to let them know where we're providing aid and services from. Now, we've had 15 displacement orders already in August, in the month of August. It works out something like almost one every 2 days. And every time there's been a displacement order, it's been affecting not only our operations, but the facilities we work from. So if you think there's health centers, there's schools where people are sheltering from, there's headquarter buildings, there's distribution centers, all of these buildings that we're working from, we have to move everything out of, move personnel, move aid, move any operations that are ongoing, patients and so on and so forth, to other areas and find somewhere else to continue giving this humanitarian response. In addition to this, the displacement orders also mean, you know, a complete restriction on our access. So the humanitarian operations are just shrinking because of these displacement orders. And even over the weekend, we had an incident with our UN agency, OCHA, where they requested 3 times to visit an area in Khan Yunis to have access to a building that had collapsed in the military operations with a family inside. 3 times this was denied, and they were unable to get to the building in time to save the family who were under the rubble. So lives are being lost, people not receiving aid. It's just a complete disaster for us trying to do our jobs on the ground here.
The displacement orders, Israel says, doesn't it, that these are aimed at protecting civilians from areas of the most intense fighting against Hamas. But the fact that there have been so many this month, does that tell us that the conflict has been escalating, just as we have ceasefire talks, which are still carrying on at the moment?
We are never far away from the front line here. The bombing, the strikes, the military operation, the tanks, they're everywhere. We are completely surrounded at the moment, all day and night. What we are hearing, what we are seeing is relentless military operations. It's terrifying for the population. People here are scared. They're fearing for their lives on a daily basis. I had a colleague just 2 days ago. The accommodation he was staying in, it was bombed next door. He lost some of his family members. This is a daily occurrence here. There has not been anywhere safe in the Gaza Strip for 10 months. People have nowhere to go. They're crammed in these shelters. You can barely see the ground anymore because it's so compact. And if you think as well, you know, it's August, the heat here is sweltering, there is sewage in the streets, there is trash piling up, disease is spreading. We're about to start, we are on the eve of distributing polio vaccinations. We've just had the first case confirmed of polio in the Gaza Strip. This is the first case in 25 years. We're about to do the impossible and start this polio vaccination campaign under these conditions. But it is just almost impossible to, you know, in these circumstances, with this bombing, with these strikes, with these continued displacement orders, to try and reach these children and give out this healthcare that they need.
Louise Wattridge in Gaza. Thank you.
Time now is 26 minutes past seven, and Sarah's here with the sport. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning once again. Well, at the US Open tennis, play actually only finished around 2 hours ago, and it was a good start for both defending singles champions, Coco Gauff and Novak Djokovic, progressing to the second round. Djokovic is bidding for a record 25th Grand Slam singles title. However, speaking to our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller, he confirmed to me that Djokovic was a touch rusty.
And he wasn't perfect in his opening match against Radu Albot of Moldova, but he still won in straight sets, and the match lasted only just over 2 hours. He was struggling on serve, Djokovic, at 10 double faults in the match. That's unusual. He also gave us a reminder that he's just finally won an Olympic gold medal. He walked onto court with his new golden racket bags, and he's chasing a fifth US Open title, which would tie the men's record in the open era, in the modern era. And also in the night session, Aryna Sabalenka, probably the favourite for the women's title, the Australian Open champion this year, she beat Priscilla Hahn of Australia.
And just to wrap up day one, Russell, a win and a loss for the Brits in action.
Yes, earlier in the day, it was Jan Czujnski, the qualifier, who nearly came back from two sets to love down, but lost a fifth set to Roberto Caballos Baena of Spain. And then at the start of the night session, Harriet Dart had a very good win over Chloe Paquet of France. She lost just three games to make it through to the second round. She'll play the 19th seed Marta Kostyuk next. And she's been coached here at this US Open by her mum, Susie, although there's no prospect of this becoming a more permanent relationship, according to Harriet at least, as her mum would miss the family dog Lenny too much. Only 3 years of age, Lenny. And apparently they FaceTime each other regularly.
Well, I think we all want to know more about Lenny now. That's going to be an ongoing discussion, isn't it? Right then, let's talk about some of the other Brits, because there are four in action on day two. But also there's going to be a lot of chat around Jannik Sinner being in action too.
Yes, Katie Bolter and Emma Raducanu in the women's draw, Jack Draper and Dan Evans in the men's draw. And for Jannik Sinner, his first match since the world learned about his positive drugs test, which did not result in any ban, as the independent tribunal decided that the contamination was inadvertent and that Sinner was not at fault or negligent. But it has been a huge talking point, as you know. Some players feel his case was resolved remarkably quickly. And there's also resentment from those who were not able to carry on playing while their cases were investigated. So we'll see whether any of this has an effect on the world number one when he takes on Mackenzie McDonald.
Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller there. Coverage of day two of the US Open continues on Five Sports Extra this afternoon from 4 p.m. The England cricket squad to play Australia in their white ball series next month included five uncapped players, meaning no space for Johnny Bairstow or Moeen Ali. And do head to the BBC Sport website for all the latest transfer news, including Manchester City agreeing a £21 million deal with Saudi Pro League club Al Hilal for defender João Cancelo. You can also read all the ongoing tributes to former England manager Sven-Goran Eriksson. We'll be reflecting on his impact on football in England with David Dean and Paul Barber just after 8:25 this morning. Sarah, thank you.
Knowledge has transformed our understanding of the universe and ourselves. But I'm here to argue that ignorance is just as important.
Every new creative endeavour basically begins in ignorance.
A new series exploring the power of ignorance from art to science to politics.
Just to have in the back of your mind that whatever I believe may in fact be wrong, because that opens me up then to being receptive to other viewpoints.
The long history of ignorance from Confucius to QAnon with me, Rory Stewart, on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather. Today will be cloudy with outbreaks of rain in the north and west. It will clear to sunny spells for some later.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, will use a speech this morning to warn that things will get worse before they get better. He'll outline the need to deal with what Labour says is not just an economic black hole, but a societal black hole inherited from the Conservatives. Ministers hope that by being open about the need for unpopular decisions, voters will be encouraged to support them. The Conservatives say the speech is aimed at distracting the public from broken promises. Paul Novak, the General Secretary of the TUC, told us public sector workers had suffered a decade of real terms pay cuts. Labour had done the right thing by accepting recommendations of pay review bodies. Ukraine's military says Russia has launched a barrage of missile and drone attacks targeting Kyiv and other cities for a second night. Reports from the capital suggest there have been at least three rounds of explosions overnight and four people have died. The United Nations has said its aid distribution in Gaza has come to a standstill after the Israeli military issued a new evacuation order for Deir al-Balah, the area that's been operating from. The UN says the latest Israeli military order effectively upends a whole life-saving hub affecting UN warehouses, water desalination plants and Al-Aqsa Hospital. People experiencing a mental health crisis in England can, for the first time, get direct support at any time by dialing 111. But the campaigning charity Mind says the scheme's success will depend on other services which are severely stretched. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that big polluters have a clear responsibility to cut emissions or risk a worldwide catastrophe. Speaking from Tonga, he said ocean temperatures were rising in the Pacific Islands at three times the rate worldwide and that its population was uniquely exposed to the impact of rising sea levels. Prices in shops are falling for the first time in nearly 3 years. The British Retail Consortium says shop prices this month were 0.3% lower than a year earlier. And Oasis fans are waiting to hear whether the band is reuniting. The Gallagher brothers ramped up speculation on social media over the weekend with an announcement expected shortly.
Alan, thank you very much. More than 7 years on from the Grenfell Tower fire, we are expecting the report of the inquiry into the disaster that claimed 72 lives next week. The speed at which flames shot up the cladding around the building shocked firefighters and led to the removal of some similar material elsewhere. But much of this work is yet to be completed. This morning, a block of flats in East London is a burnt-out shell. The London Fire Brigade says the building had a number of fire safety issues and that questions around the role of cladding will form part of the investigation into the Dagenham fire. Let's hear first from Olivia Hill, who lives in a building in Sheffield that has had a B2 rating. That means it needs remedial work in order to meet fire safety standards. Morning, Olivia.
Good morning.
How long have you been in that position of knowing that there are deficiencies in the walls of your building?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's coming up for 4 years now. I've just realised it's horrific, really.
4 years without the work being even begun?
Yes, that seems to be because of a lot of blame passing and who should be responsible for the money it's going to cost. It's going to cost almost 10 million to do the remediation. So it's a really big project that will take about 2 years.
10 million to work, to fix your building. How big is the building?
Yeah, it's only 112 flats. It's just over the 18-metre high cutoff for it to be classed as a high-rise building.
I see. And has any work begun?
No, very little's been done. We often see somebody coming out and doing tests and more surveys being done, but actually nothing drastic to improve our situation.
And so the issue in your case does seem to be who pays for it. Are you being pushed to pay for it out of service charges as leaseholders?
Yeah, we have been. It's finally been declared that it wouldn't be a leaseholder problem with the laws being changed, but there was a lot of pressure for a long time and we have certainly been paying fees for the waking watch, which was the fire marshals, and having a fire alarm fitted just so that we could remain in the building so it wouldn't need to be shut down.
So now you know legally it is not your problem. Whose problem is it?
Yeah, there's a waterfall system to go up to the original developers, freeholders and people who were responsible for this and who made the decisions when it was built.
Yeah, but essentially getting to that stage sounds long and complicated. Yeah. And in the meantime, you're living like this. So what did you think at the weekend when you saw the scenes from East London?
It's horrific for anybody to read about, but especially when it hits so close to home and thinking that, you know, one day soon I'll be wrapped in scaffolding and the building won't be the same. It needs to be fixed, but I hadn't considered that it would be unsafe in the meantime as well.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to us, Olivia. Just a reminder of the overall picture 7 years on from the Grenfell Tower. There are thought to be more than 4,600 residential buildings in England identified as having unsafe cladding, and that's buildings over 11 metres in height. Half of them have started or completing work to remove the cladding. Dame Judith Hackett is on the line. She chaired the Independent Review of Building Regulations, which I think reported, Dame Judith, about 6 months after the Grenfell fire. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of the reason that so many people are in the position that Olivia is in this morning, knowing that the buildings they live in aren't passing fire safety tests?
It's really concerning to me that so many people are left with this level of uncertainty and fear about the safety of the buildings they're in. I mean, we can all take great comfort, I think, from the fact that no one lost their lives yesterday. But nonetheless, it's a tragedy that those people have lost everything. They've lost all their belongings and everything else. And it could happen to other people. So this is a really urgent problem that needs fixing.
And let's be clear that this fire was serious enough indeed for people's lives to be in great danger. There was something like 200 firefighters called out and 100 people were evacuated, two of whom were taken to hospital.
Absolutely. And we saw a great response from the fire service. And we are very, very lucky that no one lost their lives, I believe, yesterday, given the speed with which the fire spread through the building.
What would it take?
Which is a real concern.
What would it take to fix it?
Well, it's certainly not about money. As your other speaker said, the problem of who pays and whether it was government's job to fix was resolved. And government has put up billions to fix the buildings that are rented to people. But in the leasehold case, that also has been fixed now. So this is really about people passing the buck, passing it up the chain, a lack of ownership, and actually pinning people down to do the right thing that they know they need to do.
So what do you think the new government should do then in order to fix it? Because I think the worry from people in this position might be that 7 years on from Grenfell Tower, this just might never get done if it hasn't been yet.
It has to be done. It has to be done. We have a housing crisis in this country. We know we need to build many more new homes, but ensuring that the ones we already have and those that we are about to build are safe for people to live in has to come first. And the new government must find ways, I think, of stepping up the pace on remediation and holding those who are responsible to account for doing so.
Explain exactly how this would happen. So you say this is not about the money. It is essentially about identifying those responsible and making them pay up. However, it can't be easy because it hasn't been done yet. So what is missing?
Well, what is missing in many ways is people prevaricating. And as your earlier speaker said, passing the buck further and further up the chain. We have to find a way to address that and make them collectively responsible, in my view. It can't be that the residents are left in this position of uncertainty, waiting for legal processes to wrangle this out.
Now, when you did your review, I think you did you identify high-risk buildings as those that are 10 storeys or higher? Because there'll be many people, and indeed this building in Dagenham was 8 storeys, who will feel that they don't qualify as high-risk, but they still feel unsafe.
Absolutely. The reason I identified particularly high buildings as being of higher risk is because of exactly what we saw yesterday. People got out of that building yesterday. The higher the building, the less likely it is that people will be able to get out. So I stand by that sense of there is a gradation of levels of risk. That does not mean that those buildings of lower height are not part of that urgent stock of buildings that need to be fixed and made safe.
Dame Judith Hackett, thank you very much.
It's 8:20. Let's take you through some of the other stories and ideas in the papers this morning. Page 21 of the Financial Times, very interesting piece by the chair of the Social Mobility Commission, Alan Francis, who has got a piece under the headline, "Who are the UK's left behind and what is to blame?" In other words, what's to blame for the recent riots? And he makes 2 points. He says, first, one of the things that the Levelling Up paper last year overlooked was first the clustering of disadvantage in the poorest places. private sector investment has dried up, large employers have closed, traditional jobs have gone, and there is little to fill the vacuum. Our higher education system provides a route for moving out to move up for the most academically able, but beyond this, places and their communities have been left almost entirely dependent on welfare, public services and the everyday economy. And the second point, he says, is missing from the Levelling Up white paper is the white British poor. This group is not the same as the white working class, as the Social Mobility Commission argued in its State of the Nation report last year. There are important differences in outcomes between the upper and lower working class. At the bottom is a group that includes adults and young people with low or no qualifications who are more likely to be in and out of work or dependent on welfare and the least likely to go to university. Interesting piece.
The Guardian has an analysis today that is its main story, which is revealing the number of children being referred to NHS mental health services in England for anxiety has hit the highest level ever recorded. The more than 200,000 referrals of children made with primary cause of anxiety amounts to 500 children a day being referred to specialist help. The figures, the Guardian says, lay bare the large numbers of children experiencing anxiety and the size of the task for those charged with helping them. The impact of this on the young person and those around them can be devastating, but this is also a major issue for society. Anxiety is the number one concern raised by parents to the Young Minds Helpline. They say that pressures are piling up from the cost of living crisis, devastating wars, the climate emergency, unaffordable housing. Add on intense academic pressure and an uncertain future. It's no wonder that more young people than ever before are struggling with their mental health. Family arguments and conflict can be a factor as well.
Also just worth pointing out an interesting story, page 14 of the Times. Drones feed prison drugs crisis, warns the watchdog Charlie Taylor. Chief Inspector of Prisons is saying that the volume and availability of drugs in jails is greater than ever before. And he blames the use of drones for fueling the supply behind bars. And in an interview with the Times, Charlie Taylor says the demand for drugs in prisons across England and Wales was unprecedented because of the lack of purposeful activity for inmates. Prisoners routinely locked in their cells for more than 22 hours a day.
The time is now 17 minutes to 8.
Let's turn to biodiversity, because the centre-leftish think tank, the IPPR, the Institute of Public Policy Research, is warning that the UK could miss its legally binding target to protect biodiversity and nature. That target is for 30% of land and sea to be protected for nature by 2030, the so-called 30 by 30 rule. And the IPPR say that the UK is one of the most nature depleted countries in the world, with just 53% of its biodiversity intact. Let's speak to Tony Juniper, who's chair of Natural England, joins us now. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Is the UK a particularly bad offender when it comes to this disappearing biodiversity?
Well, countries across the world are struggling with this challenge, how to align human demands with the integrity of the natural world. But in this country, I think it's particularly acute because of the demands on a relatively small area of land arising from a relatively high population for agriculture, for housing, for infrastructure, for industry. We're trying to squeeze all that in at the same time as being able to not only hang on to what we've got left of the natural world here, but also to recover it. So these are very challenging targets, but at Natural England, we're optimistic that they can actually be met so long as we've got the right program in place and that we're integrating these goals with other key sectors, especially housing, agriculture and infrastructure, so that at the same time as meeting our needs for those essential modern demands, that we're also able at the same time to rebuild the health of the natural world. But it requires a joined up approach. This is the key thing.
And just on your point about how much pressure there is on, as you say, a relatively small piece of land, you can cherry pick the numbers, can't you? But it's often pointed out that around about 10.5% of England's land is built up and about just under 10% is developed. So some people say actually a lot of England is not built on. So why is there this pressure?
Yes, intensive agriculture is the headline pressure globally for the loss of biodiversity, not just in this country. Look at the Amazon rainforest or what's going on with deforestation in Southeast Asia. It's the human food system, which is the principal motive force behind this continuing decline of species and habitats and indeed species abundance across the world. And so what we need to do, recognizing that fact, is a bit like looking at fossil fuels as the principal cause of climate change. It is food, which is the principal cause of biodiversity decline. And so finding ways in which we can bring nature back into agricultural landscapes, landscapes that are principally devoted to food production, but bringing up the wildlife populations again is a key priority. And actually in this country, we have some really exciting work going on. Many farmers across the country already fully engaged in this work, trying to bring wildlife populations, birds, mammals, insects back into the food producing landscape. And we've got these fantastic projects called Landscape Recovery, which we're delivering on behalf of government at Natural England, working with land managers, mostly farmers, to try and do this incredibly important job. But it can be done. I think is the important headline.
You said in your first answer, you pointed out that environmental policy is extremely varied and interconnected, of course. But it sounds like you think this so-called 30 by 30 rule of 30% of land and sea being protected by 2030 is important. If this country is to meet that target and it's legally binding, what's the most urgent thing? I mean, obviously, there's lots of different things you can do. But if you had to say these are the two things you've got to focus on right now, the new government.
So two things. So one is to look first to those areas where we might make most rapid progress. And I think it would be fair to say that the protected landscapes of national parks and national landscapes would be one of the first places we would go, because it is the case that we have these beautiful landscapes like the Lake District, like Dartmoor, but which are still showing very poor wildlife populations compared to what they could or should be. Okay. So we can take action in those places. It's a natural place to go. A national park, you would expect it should be full of wildlife. So we can do more there, and government can join up different policies to do that. We can help Natural England as well. And the other thing I've already mentioned is a focus on agriculture. We're already moving with these landscape recovery projects. These are large scale, integrated multi-landowner projects. Some of them, they will be blended into food producing areas. They still will be producing food. And so how you count that as part of the 30 by 30 is an important question. Government is looking at that. We will help to understand how we can legitimately count areas which are producing food as also being part of the 30 by 30.
Tony Juniper, Chair of Natural England, thanks for joining us.
It's time now for Thought for the Day at 12 minutes to 8. Our speaker this morning is Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg, Senior Rabbi of Masorti Judaism.
Good morning. It's back in March, and I'm with my plucky, hard-working rabbinic colleague, Natalie. She takes me to a viewpoint where we look north across the beautiful wooded hills. See there, she points, that's the Lebanese border. I think of the Psalms about the cedars of Lebanon planted by God. As Natalie explains, that's where Hezbollah fires at us from. The well-armed, Iran-backed terror organization has occupied the region for decades. My children haven't visited for months, Natalie tells me. We're so close to the border that there are 0 seconds warning when there's a rocket attack. Beyond here, almost everywhere has been evacuated. People don't know when they'll return to their homes. Natalie and her community are in my daily prayers. To God who makes peace in the high places, please also make peace on earth. I'm mindful too of the villages on the other side of the border. What protection do they have, utterly vulnerable, when Israel strikes back? It's not as much fun as when I'm with my classmates, testifies Zahra, a sixth grader Lebanese schoolgirl who's had to flee her home in Ait al-Shab and now studies online. I won't forget the sound of the air raid that woke us up that night. I wait for the day when I can go back to my old room. Abu Muhammad has had to leave Ait Harun. No doubt he loves his land, but the conflict has turned it into a frontline zone. How long will it take to turn it back into farmland? I pray that God, who protects refugees, will look after them too, and everyone forced to flee their homes, whether Druze, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish. We visit a Christian couple from Germany who've devoted their lives to looking after Holocaust survivors. I ask them where the group meets. Underground only. It takes too long to get them to the shelter. The couple lost their son in this war. I listen to them, brave, gentle, full of faith. I watch the family dog stretch. I think of the prayer Sheikha Ibtimam and Rabbi Tamar, two mothers, one Muslim, one Jewish, wrote together. God of life, who heals the brokenhearted, may it be your will to hear the prayer of mothers. You did not create us to kill each other, but to sanctify your name of life, your name of peace in this world. There are so many broken hearts. I hope they lead us not to bitterness, but to wisdom and mercy.
That was Thought for the Day with Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg. It is 9 minutes to eight.
The Paralympics begin tomorrow in Paris, and one sporting icon who will be central to the BBC's coverage is Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, multiple gold medalist, crossbench peer, and crucially, a campaigner for better rights for wheelchair users and others with disabilities, all of which, sadly, we were reminded of last night when she was on the 7:15pm train from Leeds to London, and when she got to King's Cross at 10 o'clock, well, she can tell us a story. Tanny, good morning.
Good morning. So I'd missed my 7:15.
You missed the 7:15, okay.
7:30, and they put me on the 7:45. But you're right, when I got into King's Cross, no one there to meet me. I waited 5 minutes before I put anything on social media, because that's, you're meant to leave sort of 5 minutes. After 16 minutes of sitting at King's Cross, no one in sight. There are a couple of cleaners, but they're not insured or able to help me off. I decided that I'd crawl off the train. So I'm going to Paris later today. I've got a few bags, had to chuck them on the platform, get out of my chair, sit on the floor right by the door, which is not particularly pleasant, and then crawl off.
I mean, I'm sorry to ask what may seem sort of rude or insensitive, but you do quite literally, I mean, you're a Paralympic gold medalist, you do quite literally mean that you had to crawl off this train on your hands and knees because you couldn't get anyone from LNER to come and help you as is, you know, their obligation.
Yeah, I mean, I can't crawl, but I sort of had to sit on the floor, drag my legs, pull myself across the floor, and then make sure I didn't lose my shoes and my phone down sort of the platform. But yeah, sit on the floor. There was no one around. I mean, I was pretty angry last night,
and
I have to say.
We know about this. Yeah, we know about this because you sent some tweets when you were angry and also on the platform we now called X Post, I think we now call it. And you've got a very big public profile. You've got a very big following. Yeah. You're a well-known campaigner. But it is straightforwardly an extraordinary thing that you had to take to social media to get some attention. Just to be clear for those who don't know how this works, did you book assistance in advance, and do you generally have to do that? And generally speaking, do people turn up and assist?
So disabled people have a legal right to turn up and go. So I had booked assistance, but I hadn't made that train. So legally, I am allowed to turn up and ask to get on a train. So my view is, once somebody has put me on a train, I have a contract, which means somebody should meet me at the other end. The booking system is not particularly fit for purpose. Every train company does things slightly differently. You know, we were meant to have level boarding in the UK January the 1st, 2020, under the Disability Discrimination Act. Every single government has kicked the can down the road. It is now going to be 100 years before we have level boarding, and I can get on a train without the permission or support of a non-disabled person. So I'm still quite angry this morning. I thought I was over it, but I'm not, because I can still just about get off the train if I have to. There are loads of people who can't. And it was only the train manager on the 11 o'clock train going north saw me getting off the train, that somebody came along. If they hadn't have seen that, I don't know whether I would have got off. I would have had to have pulled the emergency cord and then delayed the train going north.
I mean, that's absolutely appalling. I mean, the LNER... have been, you know, they put out a statement saying, "We are sorry to understand that there's been an issue at London's King's Cross station on Monday evening. We are in the process of investigating this and are in contact with the customer directly." They're talking about you. What contact have you had with them?
So I had a phone call from a senior member of LNER team last night once I was off the train, and they have been in touch this morning. They've told me an investigation has started. But I wonder, you know, not just this company, because I use them a lot. Generally, they're better than that. But if people don't have my profile, if they can't angrily tweet or get this sort of help, you know, there isn't help for a lot of other people. You know, I have a lot of privilege as a disabled person. I absolutely recognise that. Other people would have just been left in a much, much worse situation than me. And it's got to change.
But when you say, Tanny, that we're meant to be, you know, this Disability and Discrimination Act was meant to be in place January 2020, and it's been kicked down the road. I mean, why is that can being kicked down the road? I mean, what would be the reason for not introducing that?
Some of it's cost. Some of it is when trains are being procured, level boarding's not in the contract. There are some companies who build trains who don't really want to build level boarding, so make them much more expensive. And it all just gets accepted and we get forgotten about. And there are some, you know, brighter sort of sparks. Liverpool have a closed loop. They have level boarding. Some of the Greater Anglia trains have level boarding. But it's an old network. I accept it. It's not cheap or easy to do. But at what point is the government, any government, going to step in and say, okay, we need to make a change?
Because
if we want disabled people in work, if we want, you know, do all those things, transport has to be a really important part of that.
Of course. I mean, you can hear the obviously understandable indignation in your voice. I mean, is it your sense, as someone who's been talking about these issues for decades now, that there's been a lot of talk, and in the end, there has been some action, progress has been made, laws have been passed, but in the end, you're still fighting battles that a lot of people thought were settled a long time ago, frankly.
Yeah, and that's why I post on social media about these things, to make people realise that, you know, some of the access issues who haven't changed. You know, we're told there's an app to book and there's this and that, but, you know, it's not working for an awful lot of people.
And so, in this of all weeks, when the world's attention will be on the Paralympics.
Yeah. Well, you know what? London was amazing. It was the most incredible Paralympics ever. It didn't solve all these problems.
Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, sorry to hear what you've been through, but we're very glad to speak to you and very glad you did tweet about it, because we got a chance to highlight the issues. Thank you so much for joining us.
The weather now, which is with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Michelle. Yes, we've got some pretty wet and windy weather moving its way into northern and western parts of the UK, but towards the east and southeast, actually, it's going to stay dry, the rain not reaching you at all. And for eastern and southeastern areas, lots of sunshine expected into the afternoon, where it's going to be a warmer day compared to yesterday. Temperatures getting up to about 25 or 26 degrees. In southwest England, into the Midlands, it's generally fairly bright this morning with sunny spells for much of the day, but we will see the cloud thickening in the west, where there's the chance of seeing a bit of rain later in the far southwest of England, turning quite breezy, temperatures of 18 to 23 degrees. For Wales, northwest and northeast England, some blustery winds this morning, some strong gusts around the coasts in particular, a few sunny spells, but the cloud increasing as rain spreads in from the west, and that'll turn particularly heavy in the northwest, misty, murky around the coast, temperatures of 17 to 21. For Northern Ireland, it's a mild start. We've got some rain, which is clearing here already, so sunny spells into the afternoon. And for Scotland, a very wet morning, lots of standing water with heavy bursts of rain, especially in the southwest. Rain clears from the north later with some sunshine and temperatures of 16 to 20 Celsius.
Simon, thank you.
How do country houses make their money today?
We have weddings. We have parties. We need to develop a product.
How might they acknowledge problematic elements in their history?
I think it's important that the histories told by the houses shift from being the histories of the families to a much broader narrative.
How can their stories be reframed to open them up to all of modern Britain?
We're going to see the actual personalisation of content for each and every visitor that walks through the door.
Join me, Tristram Hunt, for The Grand House, Boom or Blight, this afternoon at 4 on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
And in the next hour... Oasis fans are about to find out imminently whether the band really are getting back together. And after the news, we will be hearing from the chair of the Labour Party, Ellie Reeves, ahead of a prime ministerial speech today. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of August. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer is preparing to give a major speech in Downing Street, promising to reverse a decade of decline, but also warning of challenging times ahead. Cities across Ukraine have faced a second night of heavy Russian missile and drone attacks. And thousands of mainly female workers at the retailer Next have won the final stage of their long-running battle for equal pay. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Prime Minister will promise to reverse a decade of decline when he delivers a speech in the Rose Garden of Downing Street later, but he'll also warn that things will get worse before they get better. Sir Keir Starmer will say that this summer's riots didn't just betray the sickness in society, but they also revealed the cure, to work together to fix the foundation for the long term. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
Speaking before Parliament returns next week, Sir Keir Starmer will say it won't be business as usual. No more division and distraction, no more politics of performance. He will deliver this message in the Downing Street Rose Garden in front of 50 people he met during the election campaign, from small business owners to firefighters. Promising a government of service, Sir Keir will say rooting out 14 years of rot under the Conservatives will take hard work and time, that things will get worse before they get better. Downing Street hopes that by being frank about the scale of the challenge and flagging the need for unpopular decisions, voters will be on board. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has already warned that repairing the public finances is likely to mean some tax rises in her autumn budget. The Conservatives dismiss the speech as a performative attempt to distract the public from promises they claimed Sir Keir Starmer never had any intention of keeping.
The General Secretary of the TUC, Paul Novak, told us the Prime Minister had made progress already by listening to pay review bodies and offering pay increases to public sector workers.
Unions are now consulting their members about those offers. I think it's a good first step. We all have a shared interest in making sure that we solve the staffing crisis in our classrooms, in our hospitals. 300,000 vacancies alone, staffing vacancies in the NHS and social care. And you can't fix those problems by holding down the pay of the of public sector workers.
The BBC understands that the government's looking at extending its hardship fund, which provides councils with cash so that they can make small payments to households struggling with cost of living pressures. The scheme had been due to finish at the end of next month, but the Treasury is said to be looking to extend it amid criticism of its decision to scrap winter fuel payments for some pensioners. At least four people are reported to have been killed in Ukraine in a second consecutive night of Russian air attacks. Explosions have been heard in several cities, including the capital, Kyiv. Yesterday, Russia launched one of its biggest attacks on Ukraine since the start of the war, damaging critical infrastructure. Our correspondent Nick Beek has sent this report from Ukraine's Sumy region, which borders Russia.
For a second morning, the sirens wailed as Russian missiles closed in. Blasts have been reported in at least seven cities, including Kryvyi Rih, where a woman was killed in a strike that obliterated part of a hotel. Explosions have been heard again in the capital, Kyiv, as air defence kicked in. The huge barrage that Moscow fired at Ukraine yesterday has been condemned by President Biden as outrageous. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, described it as cowardly. President Zelensky said Western allies must do more to protect Ukraine from drones and missiles, noting that a collective effort in the Middle East had successfully protected Israel from a huge aerial attack. Ukraine is also urging partners to allow it to use longer-range missiles to strike weapons stores and airfields deeper inside Russia to try to stop more of the aerial bombardments we've seen in the past 48 hours.
The UN says that new Israeli evacuation orders in Gaza have dealt a serious blow to its aid efforts, sending humanitarian workers fleeing from its operations centre. At the same time, violence has flared in the occupied West Bank, where medics say one Palestinian was shot dead by an Israeli settler and five others were killed in an Israeli airstrike. With the latest from Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yolande Now.
Aid operations ground to a halt in Gaza yesterday, a senior UN official said, with UN staff having to evacuate their operations centre in Deir al-Balah so quickly that essential equipment was left behind. The UN's humanitarian office says that the latest Israeli military order effectively upends the whole life-saving hub, affecting UN warehouses, a water desalination plant and Al-Aqsa Hospital. The order was given as the UN prepares to begin a mass vaccination program for polio after the first case in 25 years was found in Gaza. In the West Bank, the Israeli military says its aircraft struck a base for armed fighters in an urban refugee camp near Tulkarm. Amid a recent surge in violence by extremist settlers, it said it was looking into reports of a deadly settler raid near Bethlehem.
Patients experiencing a mental health crisis in England will now be able to get direct support by calling NHS 111. Health leaders say the system will be one of the first internationally to offer round-the-clock mental health support through a three-digit helpline. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
During the pandemic, local mental health crisis helplines were set up in many areas, but now there'll be a single point of access to these support services via NHS 111. People of all ages, including children, will be able to call and select an option to speak to a trained mental health professional. They can then be guided to appropriate services, including local drop-in centres and cafes run by mental health support workers. NHS England said the aim was to make it as easy as possible for people to reach services if they were in crisis. The facility will run alongside what's already available via 111 for physical illnesses and accidents. The charity Mind said it was a sensible step, but argued that the impact could be limited if there wasn't substantial investment in mental health hospitals and community services.
More than 3,500 current and former workers at Next have won the final stage of a long-running battle for equal pay. The case centred on whether shop floor staff, mainly women, were entitled to the same hourly pay as their largely male colleagues who earn more working in the retailers' warehouses. An employment tribunal found the retailer had indirectly discriminated against the claimants. Liz George is a lawyer with Lee Dame, who successfully acted for the women in the case. She told us staff at other retailers are involved in similar claims.
And we've got we've got all the major supermarkets with very similar claims. That's 112,000, I think, sales assistants. Similar claims, similar arguments. They'll be hugely encouraged by this.
The UN Secretary General has said big polluters have a clear responsibility to cut emissions or risk a worldwide catastrophe. Antonio Guterres gave the warning on a visit to the Pacific Island nation of Tonga, which is especially vulnerable to the effects of climate change. He told the BBC the world's biggest emitters, especially China and the US, needed to take urgent action.
There is an obligation for them to come together, to share technologies, to look into what the science is fortunately now producing, to make sure that emissions are drastically reduced in this decade. We need to recognize that it is totally unsustainable for the planet to go on as we are.
A think tank is warning that the UK could miss its legally binding target to protect biodiversity in nature. The Institute for Public Policy Research says urgent action is required if Britain is to carry out its pledge to protect at least 30% of land and sea for nature by the end of this decade. Alfie Tobert reports.
The report says the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world, with just 53% of its biodiversity intact. The authors say the previous government largely failed to meet the targets on nature restoration, and the new Labour administration should embed nature recovery into its agenda for national renewal. Currently, only about 3% of land in England is protected for nature. The report says that can be increased significantly without an adverse effect on food production, because the least productive 20% of English land accounts for only 3% of agricultural output. The government said Britain's nature was in crisis, and it had launched a rapid review of the Environmental Improvement Plan to make sure it would deliver legally binding targets and halt the decline in species.
In the last few minutes, it's been announced that one of the biggest music groups of the Britpop era, Oasis, are reuniting. The announcement comes after Noel and Liam Gallagher ramped up speculation on social media over the weekend. Our culture reporter Noor Nanji joins us now.
Yesterday it was maybe. Today it's definitely. This morning it's been confirmed that an Oasis reunion is on, with the band set to perform a string of gigs next year in Cardiff, Manchester, London, Edinburgh and Dublin. The announcement ends days of speculation. It's exactly 30 years since the Gallagher brothers shot to fame as the squabbling poster bad boys of Britpop. That fractious relationship was never far from the surface, and after a flare-up in 2009, Noel had had enough and left. Since then, fans of the Manchester group have been pleading with the brothers to make up and to make more music. The reason for this reunion is unclear. Are there new songs to release? Perhaps it's the lure of the limelight, or maybe it's just the money.
That was our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Alan, thank you very much. It is 8:10. Government will operate differently, the Prime Minister will say in a speech today ahead of Parliament returning next week. It won't be business as usual. There won't be division and distraction. There won't be politics of performance anymore. He'll be speaking ahead of an autumn that will include a budget in October at which the Chancellor is expected to raise taxes, after speaking of discovering a black hole in the public finances after arriving in government. Both that and a societal black hole will be part of what Keir Starmer says today. And he writes in The Times this morning about rebuilding trust in politics. Elly Reeves, Minister in the Cabinet Office and Chair of the Labour Party, is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Is this essentially what we should understand as a moral promise from the Prime Minister, that his government will be more principled, more truthful, essentially better than the last one?
Yeah, I mean, the Prime Minister today in his speech is going to talk about fixing the foundations of the country. Under the last government, we saw sticking plaster politics, papering over the cracks, but not actually dealing with the fundamental issues facing the country. And look, when we were privileged enough to form a government just 8 weeks ago, one of the first things that we did was an audit of the financial situation, and that uncovered this £22 billion black hole in the country's finances. And there's no easy solution to that. The previous government overspent in the first quarter of this financial year. The overspend was almost £5 billion, which is unprecedented. So there is a huge amount of work that needs to be done to fix the foundations. It isn't going to happen overnight. And the Prime Minister is being honest with the public about that.
I'm going to put some context around that, some independent analysis of the figures that you are giving. Paul Johnson from the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said that half of the spending hole, the black hole, as the government refers to it, is public pay, over which the government made a choice and where the pressures were known.
Well, on public sector pay, we've said that we will honour the recommendations of the pay review bodies. The important thing to say here, though, is that the previous government didn't factor in affordability into those pay review body awards. So, you know, it's right that we honour those pay review bodies. We've seen a crisis in our public services. There's issues with recruitment and retention.
Those weren't new to you, were they, on the 5th of July? They were known.
Well,
that's the point. The tone has been very different immediately after the election, within 2 weeks of the election, compared to before. So I just want to look at this broad approach that the Prime Minister is going to set out today from a few different angles. Was it, if there is a morality around it, was it moral or ethical to take winter fuel payments away from most pensioners when that wasn't in your manifesto?
That was a really difficult and hard choice, and it was because of that economic inheritance from the Conservatives, because of that £22 billion black hole, that difficult choice has had to be made. Look, you know, we've seen what happened when the previous government lost control of the country's finances, that Liz Truss mini budget with unfunded spending commitments that sent the market spiralling, and businesses and families are still paying the cost of that with their interest rates. We can't have a return to that sort of politics. We can't play fast and loose with the country's finances.
Only someone living underground would not have been able to see the pressures that were evident, would not have been able to see that we were going into an election where these kinds of issues were clearly going to rear their heads immediately after with whoever came to power. Is it still the case that Labour won't raise taxes on working people?
Well, on that £22 billion black hole to start with, I mean, the Office of Budget Responsibility didn't know about that. They've launched an investigation into it. So, you know, it is clear that there are going to be these tough choices because of that economic black hole.
Do they involve
that's
raising
been lost.
Taxes on working
no,
people
we,
now?
No, we have been clear about our tax lock. No increase to national insurance, income tax or VAT. BAT. Yeah. And we were clear about that in the election.
That still allows, doesn't it? Yes. But I'm just wondering if now, when the Chancellor has said, she said it towards the end of July to the newsagents podcast, we will have to increase taxes in the budget. That still does mean, doesn't it, that tax thresholds could change, indeed tax relief on pensions could change, which will affect working people.
But that's a matter for the Chancellor in the budget, which is going to be on the 30th of October. I'm not going to preempt what may or may not be in that. That will be for the budget.
Yeah, but again, it's a question of whether this approach you're setting out today, which is about having integrity and being truthful and being honest. There is arguably there was a lack of honesty before the election that is in stark contrast to what's happening now. But as I want to look at it from a few different angles, let me put this one to you. The Change Labour Party that Keir Starmer talks about, does that involve stopping large donations from unions, or should it involve that?
Well, there's always been a link between the Labour Party and the trade unions. You know, the Labour Party grew out from the trade union movement. There is that long, long history and that long, long link. And I think that's an incredibly important link.
More than 200 Labour or suspended Labour MPs, according to Labour List, said received more than £2 million in donations and support for trade unions in the 12 months before the election. You're comfortable with donations on that scale?
Look, the link between the Labour Party and the trade unions is an important link. It's a historic link and one that should continue. I'm sure all the donations were declared in the usual way, and I am confident in that link between the Labour Party and the unions.
But they are the ones, those are the very same unions, aren't they, who are benefiting, representing the public sector workers, who are benefiting now from the approach that you've set out in government. That's what allows a perception from some quarters that Labour is enthralled to union paymasters. It's because of the size of the donations.
Well, I don't agree with that characterisation. You know, we've seen years of industrial action, which has disrupted people's lives. It's stopped people from being able to get to work. It's led to hospital treatment being cancelled. That's why one of the first things that we did in government is get round the table and resolve those disputes so that people can get on with their lives, they can get the treatment that they need, they can get to work on time. And that was the right thing to do. And after 14 years of the previous Conservative government, you know, public services are on their knees. It's difficult to retain and recruit staff in the public sector, which is, it's really important that we've taken action to address that through the pay review body awards.
Do you still believe, as Labour did in opposition, that openness on government legal advice on whether Israel is breaching international humanitarian law in Gaza is important?
I think it's really important. And one of the first things that the Foreign Secretary did was ask for a review in relation to arms sales to Israel. That process is ongoing. But he has been clear that if items are sold to Israel, if there's a strong likelihood that they would be used in breach of international humanitarian law, then those sales would be stopped. But that is a process that's ongoing at the moment, as the Foreign Secretary is looking at.
But the point about openness and honesty is that in opposition, he made it sound much easier, didn't it? He didn't call for a review. He called for the government to publish the legal advice back in March on arms sales to Gaza. And instead of doing the same, on coming to office, he initiated a review.
Well, look, we're a new government and everything has to be assessed. But let me be clear, we have the Foreign Secretary has said that if there is a strong likelihood that items will be used in breach of international humanitarian law, then those sales will be stopped. But that process is ongoing at the moment. And the fact that this was a day one move from the Foreign Secretary, I think, highlights how important we take this. And added to that, you will know that we have repeatedly called for an immediate ceasefire and the release of hostages, and also aid being ramped up into Gaza.
When does the review report back?
That's a matter for the Foreign Secretary. I'm sure that he is looking at this very, very closely.
OK. The Dagenham fire, you'll have seen the scenes over the weekend. In 2021, you talked about the government failing to get a grip on the cladding scandal. We still today have only a third of the 4,600 affected buildings in England which have had remedial works completed. What are you going to do to get the rest done?
Well, firstly, can I just say that my heart goes out to everyone that's been affected by that fire. I know it would be incredibly difficult for the residents of that block what's happened. You know, we want remediation work to be ramped up, and I know that the housing minister will be looking at that really, really closely.
Yeah, but what's the promise to everyone who's living in one of these buildings where the work is yet to be completed and who's perhaps even more fearful this morning? What can you say about when the work will be get done? We heard earlier from someone who'd worked with the government on reviewing this area that it's not a question of money, it's a case of identifying and compelling those found to be responsible.
Yeah, and you know, it's important that developers are doing what they ought to be doing in relation to remediation works, and where they are not, action is taken. My understanding is that in blocks with Grenfell-style cladding, something like 88% of remedial works have been completed. There is further to go in blocks with other sorts of cladding that need remedial work. But as I say, I know that the Housing Minister is looking at this and work need remedial. Remediation work needs to be ramped up.
But you can't say by when it'll be completed.
I think that's a question for the Housing Minister, but it is something that we take incredibly seriously.
Ellie Reeves, Chair of the Labour Party, thank you.
It's 21 minutes past eight, and in the last few minutes, they've confirmed it. Noel and Liam Gallagher have both tweeted, "This is it. This is happening."
Me and him are like telepathic, you know what I mean?
I know my brother better than anybody else.
When both come together, you have greatness.
We made people feel something that was indefinable.
Yes, Oasis are back. The band are going to reunite and play in Cardiff, Manchester, London, Edinburgh and Dublin next summer. Tickets go on sale on Saturday. Just remember that 2.6 million people applied to get to Nebworth, one of their most legendary concerts. And I suspect there'll be more than that who apply for some of these. Let's speak to Edith Bowman, radio DJ, television presenter, presented lots of music-related television shows and music festivals over the years, and also Will Hodgkinson, chief rock and pop critic for The Times, who's interviewed both the brothers in the last year. Morning to you both. Morning, Edith. Morning, Will.
Morning.
Good morning.
Edith, if I could start with you, that's going to be one hell of a hot ticket, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think people are probably going to start just hitting repeat on their
refresh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's already crashed this morning. So, yeah, I mean, I'm finally, basically, is all I'm going to say about that for now. It's
exactly.
Like, yeah.
Will, are we both, I mean, you've interviewed them both in the past year, and they both said, I think, just having a quick look at your cuttings, that they hadn't spoken to the other for ages. I mean, are we all getting played here? I mean, was this all a massive send-up to massively boost demand for the comeback tour that was inevitable?
Maybe it was, but I don't think so. I think, you know, and you go by people's reactions, don't you? And, you know, one thing you can say about Oasis, whatever, you know, anyone says, is that they're very, very honest, and what you see is what you get. And I spoke speaking to them, and Noel would be going, well, I'm not going to call him. He, all this sort of stuff. He hasn't called me, and all that, and going backwards and forwards. So I think it's been in the works. Everybody's been wanting it, but in the event, it happened very quickly.
There's various memes, Will, that are sort of pullulating through social media that say, And occasionally some of them are serious, saying, well, there's all a political dimension to this. When New Labour were in power, Oasis were part of a big cultural moment and movement, loosely called Cool Britannia. Now Labour are back in power, Oasis are back. That's complete nonsense, isn't it? Politics has got nothing to do with this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think what they do have is a kind of, they represent a more carefree time, even though actually in the 90s it was the Iraq War, the Gulf War, all these things happening. But there's a feeling with Oasis that anything was possible.
Okay, well, Edith, just for those who are bored stiff of hearing about Oasis, just put them in a bit of a cultural and music context for us, because their sound evolved, but when they arrived, they were an extraordinary moment in British music, weren't they? They were fresh, they were new, and they were a kind of new take on rock and roll.
Yeah, they absolutely were, and they've always kind of worn their influences on their sleeve, you know, very much citing the Beatles as the main influence of them. And I think for a lot of kind of people of that age when they first came out, and I was one of them included, they were their Beatles. You know, they were a band who kind of appeared and immediately they connected with. And it was funny listening to them this morning, listening to music this morning. There's something incredibly timeless. They've been able to achieve this thing where you listen to, you know, whether it's the first album, which Liam has been out playing live over the past sort of 6 months, or you listen to the most recent thing that they did before they split up. And there's something timeless about what they have created. What I love about them as a band is the fact that they're one of those few bands that people pass down to generations. My brother, you know, passed down to his son, who cannot wait to hopefully get to see them live. My 11-year-old, just desperate to learn to play them on the guitar. You know, I think they're one of those bands that you can just, you almost like pass on with kind of pride as being something that you love.
And it's interesting you mentioned that sort of generational aspect, Edith, because there's something they've always been very clear about, their own, as you say, their own inheritances. So not just the Beatles, but the whole idea of Manchester, which is so central to the identity of music in this country. And the whole idea of these two brothers of Irish Catholic heritage, you had the worst beef since Romulus and Remus.
Yeah, I'm do you know who I'm really happy for? Peggy.
Is that,
I'm
that's
really
the mum,
happy.
Isn't it?
I'm really happy for Peggy that they've sorted it out. But listen, I think a lot of it's got to do with, you know, Liam has been putting the work in. There was a film came out a couple of years ago that Matt Whitecross directed called Supersonic. And for me,
amazing documentary.
Wasn't it fantastic? It turned the tide slightly on the opinion of Liam and Noel, I think. And something that I'd seen from interviewing them is that, you know, Noel could be a wee bit of a bully. And Liam was kind of just this playful kid who kind of had no filter. And that documentary kind of really sort of showed that. So I think that for me, it kind of was like, I'm glad that that got out there. Liam loves being the front man of a band. He loves being the front man of Oasis. He loves being Liam Gallagher. And I think that he's always said that if this happened, he would always go for it. He's always wanted it. Noel's been the one who's always going to go like, no, he's got to phone me, you know, kind of playing it a bit cool. And I think that this has been something that over time, and that Liam's put the work in, that I think Noel's kind of almost gone, well, maybe I should pick up his phone calls, or maybe we should get back in touch.
And I was just going to say, so final thought, I was going to say to Will, the nostalgics who like the idea of rock and roll and punk, when, you know, when rock stars were rock stars, you go along to a gig and you didn't quite know what was going to happen. They've still got something of that, haven't they, Will?
Yeah, they very much have. I mean, the thing is that they, you know, you can't imagine Coldplay saying about each other, you know, as Noel said of Liam, Liam's one of the angriest men in the world. He's a man with a fork in a world of soup. You know, I mean, things like that are just priceless.
There's an amazing viral thing on TikTok, Edith, about how Noel once said to explain to Liam that he put a fork in some champagne because that was a way of keeping it fresh. And then when he went round to Liam's house, he saw there was a fork and a bottle of milk. That's kind of the brothers summed up. Edith Bowman and Will Hodgkinson, thank you both very much indeed.
Some excitement for 8 o'clock this morning, followed by Sarah Orchard with the sport. Morning, Sarah.
Yes, a very good morning to you all. Overnight at the US Open, tennis defending men's champion Novak Djokovic progressed, while later today there are four Brits in action, including Emma Raducanu and Jack Draper, hoping to join Harriet Dart in the second round. Now, you can head to the BBC Sport website this morning for all the latest football transfer news, including Manchester City agreeing a £21 million deal with Saudi Pro League club Al Hilal for defender João Cancelo. But we are going to spend the next few minutes reflecting on the career of former England football manager Sven-Göran Eriksson, who died yesterday at the age of 76. Tributes have poured in. David Beckham said he was a true gentleman and that he'd be forever grateful for you making me your captain. He was the first non-British manager of the England team, leading them to quarterfinals at three major tournaments between 2001 and 2006. We're joined this morning by David Dean, former vice chair at Arsenal, but also vice chair at the FA when Sven was appointed, and Paul Barber, current chair of Brighton, but the FA's head of communications during Sven's tenure. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
David, if I can just ask you first, please take us back. How did you meet Sven and how did you actually help him get the England job?
It's a fascinating story. He first actually came on my radar screen about 1991 when he was manager at Benfica. And they beat Arsenal at the time. And I thought, well, this was a man to keep an eye on. And of course, when Kevin Keegan left England, in around about 1999, we were looking for a manager. And of course, there was, as there always is, you know, do you go for an English manager? Do you go overseas? And certainly, I always felt you had to go for the best man available. And I thought it was Sven. And we went over to Lazio, where he just actually won the Scudetto, the Italian league, the year before, and managed to persuade him to become England manager.
None of it to do with us, you not wanting them to take Arsene Wenger from Arsenal.
And Arsene had a job to do at Arsenal.
Of course, of course.
And he made that very clear.
And Paul, what was the country's reaction to a first foreign England manager? How did that evolve?
Well, it was huge news at the time. Obviously, as David said, you know, we'd recently lost Kevin Keegan. We'd had a couple of interim coaches, Howard Wilkinson and Peter Taylor, that bridged the gap between Kevin leaving and Sven arriving. But the headlines were huge. This was the first foreign coach to take charge of England, the national team. And I think people were shocked, excited in equal measure.
And did that evolve over time, Paul, in that he was really eventually taken by the English public?
Absolutely. I mean, Sven had great charisma. He was funny. He was, I think, a little bit bemused at first by the attention that he got. I don't think he was quite prepared for what came with that side of the job. And obviously, you know, got involved in things away from football as well that created other headlines. But essentially, he was a very, very good football coach, a very good person to work with. The players loved him. The staff loved him. As I say, he was charismatic. He was funny. But he was a very, very good football coach. And the players respected him for what he could do on the training field. And of course, we got some of our most famous results under his leadership.
I mean, Paul, you've teased us there. I mean, you were the communications manager, and there's no disguising that Sven's personal life was often in the headlines, particularly his relationships with women. How did you manage that? I'm sure you were busy. And what was his reaction to all that scrutiny?
Well, I think he was bemused, to be honest, by the interest in it. I think he felt that everyone was entitled to a private life. He was entitled to a private life. What he did in his sort of spare time, his private time, was really his business and nobody else's. But he also understood that as England's manager, there was going to be from time to time more interest than he would have liked. But, you know, we had to manage it. He was calm. He was pretty much the same as he ever was, you know, in any other situation. There was a big team of us at the FA that had responsibility for managing those situations, and we did the best we could. But at all times, Sven was, he was calm, he was respectful, he was honest. He did the best he could in those situations to make sure that the focus was back on the football as quickly as possible. He spoke to the players directly about those situations so that they weren't blindsided in media conferences and so on. But he was just Sven. I don't think there's anyone else that could have managed those situations quite the way he did.
And David, the football itself, he had a 60% win record, and everyone talks about that 5-1 win over Germany. What impact do you think he's had on football?
Well, I think his record speaks for himself because when he inherited the team, we were 17th in the world ranking, and when he left, we were 4th. You know, he took us to 3 tournaments. Okay, we got knocked down penalty shootouts in 2 of them, but he definitely left his mark. And as Paul said, I mean, he will be a great loss. He was a great football man. And for those who knew him, he was a really good friend and he will be missed.
Well, sadly, David Dean and Paul Barber, we will have to leave it there. But thank you both so much for your time this morning. And just a reminder that there is a special podcast, Remembering Sven-Göran Eriksson, that's available now on BBC Sounds.
Sara, thank you very much indeed. Moving tributes there. Coming up at 9 this morning, Jim Al-Khalili dives into another Life Scientific.
Hello. My guest today studies one of the ocean's most charismatic animals, the killer whale. Darren Croft's particular focus is orca family life. Killer whales travel around in close-knit family groups, each one led by an elderly matriarch who may well be in her 80s. Darren's research has revealed some extraordinary facts about the bonds within these families, especially the one between the matriarch and her grown-up sons. Even more intriguing, the findings are offering insights into the evolution of the menopause, both in killer whales and in humans. That's the Life Scientific, after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather today will be cloudy with outbreaks of rain in the north and west, sunny spells for some later.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Amol Rajan. It is 25 minutes to 9. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Sir Keir Starmer will promise to reverse a decade of decline in a speech in Downing Street, but will also warn that things will get worse before they get better. He'll outline the need to deal with what he'll say is not just an economic black hole, but a societal black hole inherited from the Conservatives. The Tories have dismissed the speech as performative. The Cabinet Office Minister and Chair of the Labour Party, Ellie Reeves, told us the government would not increase national income tax or VAT, but she didn't rule out other rises in the autumn budget. At least four people are reported to have been killed in Ukraine in a second consecutive night of Russian air attacks. Explosions have been heard in several cities, including the capital, Kyiv. The UN says new Israeli evacuation orders in Gaza have dealt a serious blow to its aid efforts, sending humanitarian workers fleeing from its operations centre in Deir el-Balah. It says the latest Israeli military order effectively upends a whole life-saving hub. And it's been confirmed that Oasis are reuniting, following widespread rumours about a comeback. The band will play a series of concerts next July and August in Cardiff, Manchester, London, Edinburgh and Dublin.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. 24 minutes to 9. Technology versus democracy is one of the central stories of our times. And right now, it's unfolding in a Parisian cell. It's there that Pavel Durov, the Russian-born founder of messaging app Telegram, is being kept in custody. Telegram has around 900 to 950 million users. It's one of those platforms to which so much public and private conversation has migrated. Some of that content is illegal in some jurisdictions. With its 950, perhaps million users, Telegram has only 100 employees. Ofmin, the French agency concerned with protecting minors from violence, obtained a warrant for Durov's address on the grounds that the app has failed to moderate content sufficiently or cooperate with regulators. Durov is an absolutely classic modern tech baron. He bears a passing resemblance to a young Steve Jobs, has lived in exile since 2014, claims to have, in effect, 100 biological children through being a sperm donor, and the internet is replete with pictures of him brandishing a physique honed by radical fasting. Elon Musk is campaigning to free him, and overnight, the French president Emmanuel Macron has said the arrest was a legal rather than political endeavour. To make sense of what's going on, I spoke a short time ago to Jonathan Hall KC. He's the UK independent reviewer of terrorism legislation and independent reviewer of state threat legislation. And I asked him if this is the latest chapter in the evolving story of how we're trying to reconcile tech power with people power, and how the internet was once a Californian utopian vision, but is slowly becoming something else.
Yeah, I think this is the third phase. The first phase was tech utopianism. Everything's wonderful. We don't need countries to tell us what to do, because once you have the internet, everyone's going to be nice to each other. The second phase was, all right, things aren't working so well, but trust us. We'll have the Supreme Court of Facebook. We'll have trust and safety. We'll have lots of regulators, moderators, etc., but internal to the companies. That obviously hasn't worked. So now I think we're at the opening skirmishes of the third phase, which is where countries are saying, we're really fed up with these tech companies, we want to impose our standards, and the tech companies are saying, please don't do that.
But different countries come with different cultures and jurisdictions. To what extent do you buy the argument that there is a kind of balkanization of the web going on? There's a Californian web, which we sort of inhabit, big, you know, West Coast companies dominating our habits. There's a more regulated European web that might be emerging. There's a Chinese walled garden. To what extent do you think that there is an issue that different countries are going to go down different paths when trying to regulate the same companies?
I think that's overstating it a bit. I mean, the Chinese regulation of the web is nothing like the European regulation of the web, nothing like the UK regulation of the web. I think that what we're seeing is the stirrings of, and I suppose right at the end of that, you might have a country saying it's simply impossible to have the web in its current form. I mean, that would be the sort of D-Day option. But in the UK, we're a long way off that. They may have got there in China, but not here.
Liberal democracies have a messy relationship with platforms like Telegram, don't they? Because on the one hand, there are people who say Durov, this very unusual, striking figure, is this arrogant rascal who believes he's above the law. But then on the other hand, in Russia, Telegram is absolutely vital for dissidents who are organising against Putin, who's seen as a bad guy. So it's pretty complicated working out where how you reconcile technology with freedoms that we believe in.
I completely agree. And there are some people who say a bit too breezily, well, this is nothing to do with free speech because it's all about selling arms and terrorism and paedophile material. And that's true. And that appears to be what the French are worried about. But I would never discount, you know, once you start having states beginning to say we need to set the standards, it will raise free speech issues. I'm not saying the states would be wrong to do that, but we need to have that in mind, I think.
What are the specific challenges posed by Telegram and, I guess, even more specifically, Telegram's unusual business model?
Telegram is completely fascinating. I mean, it's the only... There's a terrorist organisation that was proscribed by the government this year called the Terrorgram Collective. And as far as I know, that's the only terrorist organisation that's actually named in tribute to a social media platform, because this extreme right-wing collective literally organised on Telegram. And so people who were planning to carry out massacres in America, they would put online, they'd say, I'm going to do it for the gram. And back in the 2010s, it was so influential for Islamic State. I mean, it was cleaned up a bit on their public channels. So, I mean, you can't overstate, I think, just how central Telegram has been to terrorism outreach. The sort of business model point is really fascinating as well. We think, don't we, that a massive company which has got an outreach of 900 million users, I believe, will have loads of employees like, you know, Sainsbury's or HSBC. It's got 100 employees.
Astonishing.
It's completely astonishing. And so in a way, it's disqualified itself from doing what the states are asking it to do, which is why I think this battle now that's happening in France, the beginning of this battle in France, is existential for the companies, because it may be that states are saying you've got to operate in a way that you simply cannot operate according to your current business model.
So what does smarter regulation of these models look like?
I think it starts with knowing what they're doing. I mean, you mentioned that Durov is an incredibly sort of unusual guy who keeps himself very secret. We don't understand enough about these models, how they make their money. So I think the first of thing, and the European Union is I think good on this, and I hope that the Online Safety Act that the UK is bringing will come into force hopefully at the end of this year.
Eventually,
that will also bring a bit more transparency, because eventually we, I think, as consumers need to make smart decisions about which we use. And there's a very good example, which is Google Play was persuaded to remove a version of Telegram from their version of the App Store, which allowed you to get access to the Hamas channel. This was after the 7th of October. So that was a good example of consumers saying to a massive platform, we're not going to use you if, and Google thought commercially, we need to stop this. Now, Telegram then said to all their users, you can download it direct. But it may be that once consumers understand a bit more about just how little controls there are on these platforms, in 100 people is not going to keep your children safe, is it? Then people might start saying, well, I'm not going to use that anymore.
And what about this central question of whether or not the owners, Durov, Telegram, are responsible for what material appears on their platform, whether they're social media platforms or messaging platforms, which are subtly different things. So Telegram say, it is, and I quote, it is absurd to claim that a platform or its owner is responsible for abuse of that platform.
I think you can sidestep that question a bit. I mean, what you're alluding to is the famous are you a publisher of material debate. And in the United States, you've got very strong constitutional protection of free speech. And you've also got something called Section 213 of the Communications Decency Act, which says you are not going to be a publisher. It's very hard for a country like the UK to change US law, particularly constitutional law. The real question is, what is the harm that's being caused? Whether you call them morally responsible or not, there clearly is harm being caused. And the question is, what steps practically can states like the UK and the EU take to try and diminish that harm?
Are you satisfied that we've got a good enough definition of harm?
No, I mean, I'm sitting from the sidelines watching. I think the UK are probably quite pleased that it's not actually in the thrust of this battle, and they'll be watching with huge interest what's happened in France. Our online safety act, as we mentioned, is going to come into force, and I guess we're sort of thinking what's going to happen.
Well, John Stuart Mill struggled to define harm, so maybe you and I could struggle too. Jonathan, very good to chat to you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
It is coming up to 9:15. A new episode of the Radio 4 series 3 Million about the 1943 Bengal famine is coming this week, with testimony from those people still alive today who can remember a dark period of hunger and death in British India. Kavita Puri, presenter of the series, joins us now. What does this testimony add to the picture already gathered, Kavita?
Well, I've been tracing this hugely difficult bit of both our war story and colonial history with eyewitnesses from the time, as well as looking at this really complex legacy with descendants like Susanna Herbert, whose grandfather was the colonial governor in Bengal at the time in the famine. But the voices who are at the heart of this story are the survivors, and they have almost never been asked about their experiences. It's probably worth remembering that 3 million is the estimated number of people who died, but millions more survived. And so I travelled deep into the countryside in West Bengal, in India, to find them. And these are some of their recollections. Some of them are distressing.
I was only 9 years old then. During the famine, my father was poor. He could no longer afford to buy rice. He took us to Kolkata. He said, if we lived here, we would die of hunger.
Jamuna Pokayath is 91. She is tiny, but speaks with authority.
He carried me on his shoulder from the village to the station. My mother and brother were with us. We went by train towards Calcutta.
The train was packed. Many hadn't bought tickets. They were desperate. It was a harrowing scene and almost unimaginable that a 9-year-old could witness such suffering.
Babies were hungry and crying for food. A mother was holding her baby on her breast, but she was not able to feed her as she was not producing any milk. Her breast had dried up from starvation. The baby died while on her breast in the train.
Once in Calcutta, there were many people on the streets. They were asking for food or money. Soon, she joined them. She's never forgotten one young girl who showed her kindness.
She was fair, a bit plump. The girl gave us 2 pieces of bread with jaggery. My brother ate one, and I ate the other piece. Our parents didn't eat any.
Her father soon managed to get a job, so they were just about surviving. If you had stayed and not gone to Calcutta, do you think you would have survived?
We would have been dead. We wouldn't have survived. We would have had no food. We would have starved to death. That was the reason why Dad took us there.
We travel deeper into the Sundarban jungle near the border with Bangladesh and stop at a mud house. An elderly man is sitting, waiting. He's bare-chested in a dhoti. He's in his 90s, and his name is Sheikh Qasem. His voice is a whisper.
My older brother died of hunger. I was very young at the time. I was crying so much, uncontrollably, my mother couldn't stop me.
These survivors, old now, towards the end of their days, lived through a devastating famine when they were British subjects, forgotten casualties of World War II. But they didn't forget, even if others may have.
When I think of my older brother, I feel very sad. I weep. I still cry for him. He had left us. It is now my time to leave too.
That was Kavita Puri reporting. The new episode of 3 Million is on Radio 4 on Thursday at 9:30. And the rest of the series is available now to listen to on BBC Sounds. It's nearly 10 to 9, and a Palestinian living near Bethlehem is reported to have been killed in a raid overnight in the occupied West Bank by Jewish settlers. Meanwhile, agencies in Gaza say they have had to suspend aid distribution because of the fighting, and the families of more than 100 hostages taken from Israel 10 months ago continue to wait and hope that there may yet be a ceasefire that brings them home. Talks have been continuing in Cairo, and our Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf joins us from there. Rushdie, what can you say about the status of those talks and the outlook this morning?
Yeah, there was a Hamas delegation in Cairo, a senior Hamas delegation here for 2 days. And they told me that what they have been offered isn't enough for them to accept it. I understand from the mediators, the Qataris and the Egyptians and the Hamas, which involved in the talks, that the sticking points, to make it just simple for our audience, is two things. Is one thing that they said the Israelis want to keep forces in Philadelphia corridor, and this is the corridor that along the border between Egypt and Gaza, which Hamas rejected. The second issue is that Israel want to keep also control of the what is called now Netzarim checkpoint. It's the area that divided Gaza into two parts, north and south. And Israel want to keep also forces in this area, and they want to check, security check, every person going back to the north was, you know, displaced back in October, which also Hamas reject. What the mediators are trying to do now is to try to bridge this gap and try to find some solution for Hamas. They said, we are not going to accept any ceasefire proposal that is not included the complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces from Philadelphia corridor and Netzarim checkpoint.
The U.S. Secretary of State, when he was in the region last week, thought that he had found a way through this, didn't he? He thought that there was a bridging proposal. How involved are American officials, Egyptian officials, Qatari officials in? Are they essentially shuttling between the two sides?
Yeah, you know, there is no direct negotiation between Hamas and Israel. It never happened. It's always indirect negotiation. And we have seen senior Egyptian, American and Qatari officials, they met in Doha about 10 days ago, and they met again in Cairo last Sunday. So there is a senior level involvement by the Americans, the Qatari and the Egyptian, but they haven't managed to solve the two issues. And from Hamas point of view, they said this is the minimum we can accept. We want the people, about 1 million people who were displaced from the north, to go back freely to the north without any security check. For Israel, they want to make sure that Hamas militants will not be allowed to go back with their weapons into the north. The second issue is the issue of the border, because Israel said Hamas has smuggled most of the weapons from Egypt, and they want a security arrangement that's stopping Hamas in the future from importing or, you know, smuggling any weapon from the Egyptian side. So that's why they're keeping the forces in the Philadelphia corridor. For Hamas, they said, we cannot accept any ceasefire or any proposal that not include the complete withdrawal from Philadelphia and from Netzarim. And this is the issue that the mediators are trying to solve, and so far they haven't managed to do anything.
And in the meantime, inside Gaza, as of this morning, the UN is saying that aid distribution is on hold, essentially, because of the extent of the fighting.
Yeah, and most important is the recent Israeli evacuation order to Al-Aqsa Hospital. And, you know, Al-Aqsa Hospital is the main hospital in the middle camps. It's in a small town called Deir el-Balah. This town, the original number of people living in it before 7th of October was 80,000 people, and now there's about 800,000 people they live in Deir el-Balah, and now they have to live without a hospital, because the part of the evacuation order given to the people inside this area of Deir el-Balah is the Al-Aqsa Hospital. Well, the hospital itself has not received direct order from the Israeli army to evacuate the hospital, but it's in a fighting, it's in a combat area, and most of the patients and the people who were displaced in the hospital were left yesterday. This morning, the Hamas-run health ministry said that they still have medical team inside the hospital and they are still functioning. But imagine if there was 700 patients treated in the hospital and now they are down to 100. Seven of them are in a very critical condition in the ICU units. So now the middle camps area, which about, as I said, 800,000 people, is left with two small field hospital that they are not proper hospital and they are not suitable to treat this number of people, especially the number of airstrikes and attacks in this area increased in the last 2 weeks.
Rushdie Abu Alouf in Cairo. Thank you.
6 minutes to nine, and a little treat to end today's programme. How many of the 37 novels written by Anne Cleves have you had the pleasure of reading? They have sold millions of copies all around the world, earned many an award along the way. She's perhaps best known for the detectives Jimmy Perez and Vera Stanhope, both of which have been turned into very successful TV shows. Shetland for the BBC, Vera for ITV, and she has a new book out. It's called The Dark Wives. It's a Vera Stanhope novel, and it centres around a children's care home. And it came about after Anne heard a File on 4, that's a programme here on Radio 4, about poor living standards in privately run care homes. The TV version is already in production, and Anne Cleves has joined us in the studio. Hi, Anne.
It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's so wonderful to talk to you. And just before we get into the books, miraculously, this is your first time on the Today programme.
It is, and I've listened to it since I was first became an adult, I think.
Fantastic. Well, it's a privilege to see you here. What happened then? So you're listening to File on 4 on Radio 4, and something just struck you as profoundly wrong and important to write about.
I think so. This is definitely my angry book. I listened to the programme, and I just felt very queasy that there were people making money out of our troubled teenagers, and that the programme wasn't just about corruption and how people were making money out of local authorities, but it was just about the lack of care, that no consistent care, that agency staff just coming in to cover, and that sense that our young people deserve so much better than that, especially kids that have been through chaotic lives or parents who've had problems or parents who've been ill or addicted and haven't been able to look after the children properly. And where's the kindness and where's the care that we want for our kids and our grandkids and that those children aren't getting?
You think it's the ultimate measure of a society in a way is how it looks after the most vulnerable kids in its in its presence. Tell us about Vera Stanhope, for those who don't know. What is the appeal of D.I. Vera Stanhope to so many people?
I think she's a woman of a certain age who has authority, who's competent, but really doesn't care at all what she looks like. And I think there are lots of, not just women actually, but people who feel unseen and unheard, because she wouldn't be seen if she sat in an important meeting. People would judge her. As we judge kids who've just come out of care, we make assumptions about people.
And yet she's become this TV giant, really. And I just wonder how you as a writer feel about the TV adaptations that have, on the one hand, brought your work to millions of people. It must have helped with the book sales, of course. But is there also a slight sense of mixed feelings because you have a sense of a loss of control?
Yeah, I don't mind the loss of control. And from the beginning, I thought that the production company who makes both those shows actually got the character and got the atmosphere. And again, certainly within Vera, kindness matters in the books and it really matters in the show as well.
How do you, as a writer, as a crime writer, as a mystery writer, how do you optimise the jeopardy and suspense that makes books in the lingo unputdownable?
I'm not sure. No, I really don't have a technique for that because I don't plot in advance. So it has
you
to
what?
Be...
You,
no.
You so, don't know the ending before you start writing?
Sometimes I don't even know who the victim is when I start writing. So it has to keep me interested and it has to keep me going. So I just sit at my kitchen table after the first quarter of an hour of the Today programme, drink lots of tea and make stuff up.
What is it about the business coverage on this programme that inspires you to write? Hang on, so when you started on sort of The Dark Wives, you didn't necessarily know where it was going to end up?
Not at all. No, I had a vague idea where it was going to end up because it ends up with it's set in the autumn and it ends up with a witch hunt. So a woman dresses up as a witch in a rural village in Northumberland, and it's a tradition from one pub where the woman goes out and plays at a witch and the kids all run around on the fells and try and find her. And that
that does happen. But, so I thought that would be quite a good thing to end with.
But if you write that way and it unfolds organically, at the end you go back and change things, or do you find that the way it unfolded dramatically is just that's the final version?
Pretty much. I edit a bit as I go along. So I do know that I'm going to twist a bit or change direction. I'll go back and rewrite bits to make sense. And then you do have to play fair with the reader. So I'll make sure that there are enough red herrings, but also enough clues to what's actually going on, because that's fun.
How have you found your debut on the Today programme?
I'm so giddy to be here. You wouldn't understand.